Hold on, mute all.
And then put it in record, Howard. Oh, it is. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the primetime presentation of the books behind the book from the New Jersey archivist and historical. What is it, Northern New Jersey? They'll introduce themselves. We're very grateful to have them here, and Primetime is proud to present it. This will be on our primetimeisnow.com website, audio only, and then because of anonymity issues, we're not putting the video. But we will also get the slides that are going to be shown. We'll get them as a separate PDF, so those that want to look at the books more closely and go back and maybe listen and whatever, they'll have that. So it's now. We will have a Q&A after this. And there'll be, I believe, like five people making presentations. So it's now my honor to introduce Frank, who is going to begin this presentation for the group. There you go, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig, so very much. And good morning and good afternoon to everyone. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Frank. I'd like to thank the Primetime Is Now LA group for inviting us, the History and Archives Committee of Northern New Jersey, Intergroup, and Area 44 to bring our presentation of the books behind the book and to bring able to shed a little light on the question, where did the big book come from? So let's now light that lamp and place it on the table so everybody in the room can come into that light and light up the house. So to start this off, I want to bring up our first presenter is Jill S. So, Jill.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jill, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Big Book Study, which meets on Monday nights in Neckong, New Jersey. And it's a fantastic group, and it's a privilege to be here. So, where did the Big Book come from? Many of us have thought and said that the Big Book was divinely inspired, and we still feel that way. For a drunk like Bill Wilson, with just 4 years of sobriety, to write such a spiritual book, there was obviously some outside assistance from above. And Bill is given credit as being the primary author of the book. But what many don't know is that the many of the ideas and concepts that we find in the Big Book already existed. Perhaps Bill could be better described as a master chef. He merely took the right ingredients in the right quantities and put them in a pot at the right temperature to simmer into the wonderful meal we have today. So, what are the sources of the principles of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Where did our big book come from? We think Bill Wilson answered the question in the address to deliver to the Medical Society of the State of New York on May 9th, 1944. Bill stated, "At the very outset, we should like to make it ever so clear that AA is a synthetic concept, a synthetic gadget, as it were, drawing upon the resources of medicine, psychiatry, religion, and of our own experience of our drinking and recovery. You will search in vain for a single new fundamental." We have merely streamlined old and proven principles of psychiatry and religion into such forms that the alcoholic will accept them. And then we have created a society of this, of his own kind, where he can enthusiastically put these principles to work on himself and other sufferers. Bill goes on to say, "Alcoholics Anonymous has made two major contributions to the program of psychiatry and religion. These are, it seems to us, the long missing links in the chain of recovery. One, our ability as ex-drinkers to secure the confidence of the new man to build a transmission line into him. And two, the provision of an understanding society of ex-drinkers in which the newcomer can successfully apply the principles of medicine and religion to himself and others." Wow. So, Bill says AA was drawn from the resources of medicine, psychiatry, and religion. He goes on to say that he took old and proven principles of psychiatry and religion and streamline them into such forms that the alcoholic would accept them. I think we have here an excellent concept and definition of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a program in the form of a book based on the old and proven principles of psychiatry and religion, and a society where we get to work these very principles on ourselves and others. But that word streamlined is very important to us in AA. Let's see what that word means. The word streamline, in the past tense of the verb streamline, it means design or provide with a form that presents very little resistance to a flow of air or water, increasing speed and ease of movement. And or two, make an organization or system more efficient and effective by employing faster or simpler working methods. What Bill actually did was take much of the altruistic principles and history of early Christianity found in the New Testament and dropped the personalities from them in this form, which seemed more spiritual rather than religious. The alcoholic could accept them. This proved to be the keys to the kingdom for the alcoholic, because most alcoholics had fairly extensive resentments toward their childhood religions. The initial approach was thus more psychological in nature. So let's see these fundamentals. Let's see the books behind the book. The first book we want to tell you about is The Common Sense of Drinking, written by Richard R. Peabody. Published in 1934, this 191-page volume was written by an alcoholic, Peabody, who had recovered through the program of the Emmanuel Movement in Boston. Peabody went on to become a lay therapist, perhaps the first such alcoholism therapist in New York City, and had an office near the Calvary Church, where Bill Wilson was attending meetings of the alcoholics. From this title, Bill Wilson borrowed phrases such as once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, half measures are of no avail, and perhaps the entire story of a man of 30 contained in the chapter More About Alcoholism. Note the very interesting question Peabody posed on the cover of his book. Is your drinking hereditary? Is your drinking chronic? What makes you drink? Are you an alcoholic? What is your danger line? What are the causes? What is the cure? Are you a specialist in avoiding life?
Thank you, Jill, very much for that part of our presentation here. And our next presenter up is Brian G.
Hi, my name is Brian. My home group is Middletown Friday Night Out, and that is in Middletown, New Jersey. Our next book behind the book is quite possibly the most important, and that is The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. Remember what Jill told us before, that religion was so roundly rejected by alcoholics. Bill would use the most important text in the great stature of the father of American psychology to help legitimize the need for religion and recovery from alcoholism. Published in 1902, this 526-page book was read by Bill Wilson following his spiritual experience in Columbus Hospital in order to better understand what had happened to him. The book was given to him by Ebby. Religious or spiritual experiences, James thought, had the power to transform people. Some were sudden, quickly. Others came on gradually, slowly. Some flowed out of religious channels. Others did not. But nearly all had a great common denominator of pain, suffering, and calamity. Complete hopelessness and deflation of death were almost always required to make the person ready for the transforming experience. Bill Wilson reasoned to have a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. There had to be complete failure of the will in a certain one's life. With the alcoholic, it was the ability to control one's drinking. There had to be an admission of failure. There had to be a cry for help. Thus, the AA procedure of telling one story, stressing the progressive loss of control and the fatal nature of the malady consisting of the physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. When these facts were driven home, the alcoholic could surrender to the problem and become open to the solution. Our next book behind the book is that other book, The Good Book, the King James Version of the Bible. The early members all read and studied the Bible and concentrated upon the following three areas. Matthew chapters 5-7, Jesus' sermon teaches many of AA's underlying principles, including thy will not mine be done, first things first, easy does it, forgiving to be forgiven, and the principle of restitution. 1 Corinthians 13, Paul listed the aspects of love and the points of what love is not. He also points out the distinction between gifts, perfection, and love. The book of James, the theme of James, writing in Christianity in action, deals with a series of topics which were of great interest to the alcoholics. These topics are 1 verses 1-18, trials and temptations, 1 verses 19-27, listening and doing, 2 verses 1-13, mercy and judgment, 2 verses 14-26, faith and works, 3 verses 1-12, taming the tongue, 3 verses 13-18, true and false wisdom, 4 verses 1-12, friendship with God, 4 verses 13-5:12, investing in the future, and 5 verses 13-20, the power of prayer. The phrase faith without works is dead is taken directly from the book of James. In fact, the book of James was so popular with the early members, many favored naming the fellowship the James Club. That is one of the early ideas that needed to be streamlined. Along with the Bible, the early members were all reading the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. Published in 1934, this 199-page volume was used by the early AA members and those in the New York area who attended Fox's lectures at Steinway Hall. Fox explains that the Beatitudes are a prose poem in 8 verses, Matthew 5, which is complete in itself and constitutes what is practically a general summary of the whole Christian teaching. Robert Speer had written The Principles of Jesus in 1902, in which he had distilled the Beatitudes into 4 absolutes. The book was of special interest as the Oxford group had adopted 4 basic points: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love as guides to our life in God.
Thank you, Brian. And our next presenter up is Sarah S.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic, and my home group is the Haldon On a Different Footing Big Book Study. We meet on Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. in Haldon, New Jersey, and we're currently a hybrid meeting. Our next book is Man the Unknown by Alexis Carroll. Published in 1935, this 346-page volume was the turning point in determining what focus the big book should take. Bill Wilson had said in 1944, on reading that book, Man the Unknown, some of us realized that was just what we had been groping towards. We had begun to build a program out of our own experiences. At this point, we thought, let's reach into other people's experiences. Let's go back to our friends, the preachers, the social workers, all those who have been concerned with us, and review what they've got and bring it into synthesis. And let us, where we can, bring them in where they will fit. It was from this text that Bill came to understand the value of both medicine and religion in treating the alcoholic. As a Man Thinketh came to us from James Allen. Published in 1910, this volume can vary in page quantity, but is usually printed as 59 pages. This book was used by early members to understand the principles of cause and effect. That a man is literally what he thinks, his character being the complete sum of all his thoughts. That man creates all of the circumstances of his life through thought, and his environment is the reflection of these circumstances. That the mind must be treated as a garden, and man must learn to identify and remove those weeds. That we must learn to crucify ourselves on a daily basis, as daily living demands daily dying. Thus, the core AA ideas that we must get down to causes and condition. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. That some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Our next book behind the book is The Greatest Thing in the World by the evangelist Henry Drummond. Written in 1883 at a mission station in Africa, Drummond first delivered his lecture on love at the 1887 Northfield Conference in Massachusetts. This volume is an analysis of the 13th chapter of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, explaining that the greatest thing in this world is love. Drummond describes the spectrum of love as having 9 elements. Patience, love suffereth long. Kindness, and is kind. Generosity, love envieth not. Humility, love vaunteth not itself, is not easily puffed up. Courtesy, doth not behave itself unseemly. Unselfishness, seeketh not her own. Good temper, is not easily provoked. Guilelessness, thinketh no evil. And sincerity, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in truth. To these 9 aspects, the early members of AA added gratitude and tolerance.
Thank you, Sarah, for that. And our next presenter up is Al Kay.
Hello, everyone. My name is Al Kay. My home group is Live Easy But Think First in Kearney, New Jersey. Our next 2 books were very influential for Bill in writing the big book. Bill Wilson ended up adapting the format used by Harold Begbie in his books Twice Born Men and More Twice Born Men. The first, Twice Born Men, Broken Earthenware, was published in 1909. This 280-page volume was dedicated to William James and is a collection of the personal stories of men recovered through spiritual experience while in contact with the Salvation Army in London, England, even before AA drunks were sobering through the power of religion. The stories have titles such as A Tight Handful, The Criminal, The Copper Basher, Lowest of the Low, Rags and Bones, and Apparent Failure. The big book contains similar anonymous titles. The second book, More Twice Born Men, The Life Changers, published in 1923, tells the story of the leaders of the Oxford Group. By the fall of 1922, the core group of converts, groupers, had emerged from the first house parties at Cambridge and similar gatherings at Oxford. Claude Sutton, Robert Collis, Luden Hamilton, Sherwood Day, Henry Van Dusen, Murray Webb Peplow, and Sam Shoemaker had become known as the Life Changers. Their personal stories were told in Harold Begbie's 1923 book, More Twice Born Men. Begbie began the book with the story of Frank Buckman, followed by a wonderful chapter on the possibilities of conversion titled According to Thy Faith. Bill Wilson followed suit in the big book with Bill's story and There Is a Solution. More Twice Born Men contains 7 personal stories of the men named above, Greats, A Rugger Blue, A Beau Ideal, persona grata, Princeton, A Young Soldier, and Sam Shoemaker's The Virginian. Our next book comes to us from the Oxford grouper who chose anonymity and signed the book The Layman with a Notebook. Written by Ralph Neely and published in 1933, this 132-page volume was considered the basic text of the Oxford group, and its purpose was to explain the basic principles of the group's life-changing program and practical spiritual activities. The Oxford group had four basic points, which are the keys to the kind of spiritual life God wishes us to lead. These points are: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. To be spiritually born and to live in a state in which these four points are the guides to our life in God, the Oxford group advocated four practical spiritual activities. These activities were the basis for our 12 steps. 1, the sharing of our sins and temptations with another Christian life given to God, and to use sharing as witness to help others, still unchanged, to recognize and acknowledge their sins. Sharing for confession became steps 4 and 5, and sharing for witness became the telling of our stories. 2, surrender of our life, past, present, and future, into God's keeping and direction became steps 2 and 3. 3, restitution to all whom we have wronged directly or indirectly became steps 8 and 9. Listening to, accepting, and relying on God's guidance and carrying it out in everything we do or say, great or small, became step 11.
Thank you, Al. And Gene P. is going to take us through the rest of this book. Gene,
maybe you're muted.
Sorry about that. I'm so sorry. Hi, my name is Gene. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Kearney, Live Easy But Think First, in Kearney, New Jersey, and I serve as the District 13 DCM there. These activities proved indispensable to countless numbers who are living changed lives. They are not new ideas nor inventions of the Oxford group. They are the simple tenets of simple Christianity. What is the Oxford Group, 1933? So you can see it was the simple tenets of simple Christianity that Bill adopted in the vein of principles before personalities. They were ancient practices common to all of mankind and streamlined into such forms that the alcoholic could accept. Here are some of the other Oxford Group books that found their way into the big book. The first of the other books behind the book is When Man Listens, God Speaks by Cecil Rose, published in 1937 by New York Oxford University Press. Its main theme was that when man listens, God speaks. When man obeys, God works. Many of the ideas in this book found their way into the basic text. Willingness for him to take charge will mean an honest and thorough scrutiny of every area of my life. It will bring to light all sorts of things that I have not been willing for God to alter. Habits, indulgences, wrong relationships, personal ambition, opinions, and sheer self-will. Next, we have I Am a Pagan by Victor Kitchen. Published in 1934 by Harper and Brothers, This book told the story of the changed life of Victor Kitchen. The book talks of moving from paganism to destiny, or as Kitchen said, the business of getting back to God. It was certainly this book that gave Bill Wilson the idea behind the steps. They said, however, that I could have it just as they did if I would pay the same price, comply with the same conditions, and go through the same series of exceedingly simple steps. Kitchen says, "Thy will be done" was substituted for "I am the captain of my soul." And lastly, we have For Sinners Only by A.J. Russell. Published in 1932, this 347-page volume was a testament to the effectiveness of the Oxford Group. The book describes in detail the aims and processes used to bring a person to a changed life. The Oxford Group describes sin as anything which blocks a person off from God or his fellow man. From chapter 5 of Russell's book, Bill borrowed much of the writings on self and how self functions. Most of the ideas contained in steps 3, 4, 5, 8, and 9 came directly from this book.
Thank you, Jean. And we're going to bring up our archivist, John B., to finish up. And I neglected to identify myself. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Frank, but my home group is the Hohokus Group in Hohokus, New Jersey. I'm also part of the GSR Midwinter Luncheon Committee that had our virtual presentation of honoring GSRs in our Area 44 2 weeks ago. And but again, and my sobriety date is September 25th, 2009. And now we have John to finish up. John.
Hi, everybody. My name is John, and I am alcoholic. And I'm going to go ahead and share some of my screen now, if it's okay. And I want to thank Frank and everyone for bringing this presentation to you. Hang on, I'm just looking to get this slide started here. Hang on 1 second, folks. I'm sorry. It seems like something's covering my screen here. Let me try to minimize this. Anyway, I am John. I am privileged to serve as the archivist, one of the two archivists from Area 44 in New Jersey. And I want to just kind of go over some of the printing history of the book. And again, I'm just trying to get this thing to run here. Hang on 1 second. I'll get it going in just a...
John, if you scroll down to the bottom of the page where we've got that little stand. You see the...
Yeah. Let me, this one here, right?
That one right there. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. So let's hope that's not the beginning. We'll know in a second. No, thank you, Frank. I appreciate that. So the book first came out in 1939, and here we see the, you know, the four editions that, are in play. So the first edition, which came out April 10th, 1939, there were 300,000 copies distributed from 1939 to 1955 in 16 printings. And the very first printing of the first edition, which you can see on the left, had 4,730 copies. And if you were able to get your hands on one of these books, you know, you're looking at a minimum of five figures for the value of this book. 1941, the second printing of the first edition had come out. The second edition came out in 1955, and all told, there were 1,150,000 copies distributed, again, over 16 printings. And Bill had always said, you know, we came out with the second edition in order to kind of update the stories. And I think you'll see right in the flyleafs of the book, you know, that there's been strong sentiment against making any radical changes to the book. So they really just went ahead and updated the stories. So now I'll give you a little bit of trivia. So the 1,000,000th copy of the big book was given to none other than Tricky Dick. So Richard Nixon, who was the president at the time, and I think it was in 1972, was given the 1,000,000th copy of the big book. So now the third edition, which came out in 1976, there were 19,550,000 copies distributed of this book. And when you look at that, you say, wow, what a major leap. What was that all about? Well, in 1972, the United States passed what was known as the Hughes Act, named after Senator Harold Hughes, which began to place alcoholism in the forefront with medicine. 1956, the American Medical Association had classified alcoholism as an illness, but they stopped seriously short of calling it a disease. And of course, Marty Mann and the National Council on Alcoholism, she had worked tirelessly, you know, to bring about the concept that alcoholism was a disease. So now in the 80s, the American Medical Association finally classified alcoholism as a disease. And that opened the door for insurance now, third parties, to pay for the treatment. And who became the biggest seller of the book at that point was Hazelden. And these 19,550,000 copies are all what came about as what I would call the start of the 28-day rehab program. So if any of you have gone through a 28-day program, I'm sure there's a few of you out there that have. Some of us have gone two or three times. I'm raising my hand. You can't see me. You were given a big book. So this is how, you know, it just mushroomed into, you know, going from 1,150,000 copies to 19 million. So in 2001, the conference had approved publication of the fourth edition of the big book. So when we first authored this presentation, which we presented in 2019 at the New Jersey conference, we had used the statistics that, you know, as of December 2018, more than 37,500,000 copies of the book Alcoholics Anonymous had been distributed. So now in 2020 at the virtual international convention in Detroit, Dr. George Kube of the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism was given the 40 millionth copy of the book as an expression of AA's gratitude for the long history of cooperation and communication between Alcoholics Anonymous and professionals. Whoops, sorry for the typo, in the field of alcohol abuse and alcoholism. And it was the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism under the guidance of the parent organization, which is the National Institute of Health, that helped to finalize and give alcoholism that designation as a disease that then opened it up so that insurance could pay for the treatment. And that was ever so important. You know, a lot of people, I've heard people say that the big book is the most printed book, and that's not true. The big book, though, is a very important book, and in 1988, it was given a designation by the Library of Congress as one of the most important, the 100 most important books ever published in American history. The big book was given place 88, and I don't think any of us who have read the book and studied the book, you know, would quarrel with that designation. It's certainly one of the most important books in the history of not only America, but spirituality as well. And, you know, to answer the question, what is the most printed book? The answer would be the Bible. The Bible has been printed more and in more languages than any other book has ever been and perhaps ever will. And behind that are a number of Chinese texts, only by virtue of the number of people in China that then purchased them. So that's our presentation. I just want to say thanks to Frank and the rest of the committee that helped to present it. It's certainly been our privilege. The books that you saw, we would strongly encourage you to try to get your hands on them, read them. If you read them, you're going to see, you know, much of AA in those books. As I read them, I said, wait a minute, they took that from AA. Oh, they took that. Even as I read the Bible, you know, and Dr. Bob read the Bible three times over. I said, they took that from AA. Oh, no, you know, that book came out first. That was that other big book. But these books are just so packed with our principles. And as I said, you know, in the spirit of tradition 12, a lot of the personalities were removed and we were left with the principles. So now I think we have some opportunities to do some question and answers. So again, I'm just trying to get to my meeting controls here. Okay, stop share. And maybe what I'll do is I'll turn my video on so you guys can see me. So if one of the hosts can take it over, we can start the question and answers. We'll do our very best to answer whatever questions you might have.
Thank you so much. I'm Craig. I'm an alcoholic. Great presentation. Very informative. And thank you so very much for your dedication. I got a quick question. I've been curious. When the spiritual appendix came out, did that come out in the first edition and a later printing, like when they realized, you know, where all the asterisks are and takes you to page, 567 in the fourth edition? Was that in the first edition? We were having a meeting. We were wondering when that was added as an addendum, the spiritual experience.
So the Appendix 2 was added in the second printing of the first edition.
Right. Okay.
Came out in 1941. And, you know, I think it clearly says it in the appendix. So a lot of people were confused, you know. Did I have to have this spiritual experience, you know, the white light experience that Bill Wilson had described? And then he comes out and says, no, you know, a lot of us have what William James described as. And, you know, William James never said this exactly. So Bill is kind of paraphrasing. He says what James called the educational variety. So James had said, look, sometimes these things come about quickly. So that's the sudden type that Bill had had. And he says sometimes they come about more slowly as a result of kind of applying these principles. So, that came out in the second printing, and it was meant to clarify that you didn't have to have this sudden bright light type of experience. So, although many did, most of us had, you know, this more educational type.
Thank you, John. So I see hands up, and I'm going to call them in the order that they were raised. I just want someone commented me privately that they were annoyed by my having the phone is part of my control system.
I have an iPad for my video, and it's easier for me to keep up on the muting and everything. So just a little clarification of why I'm on both. I'm not here on Facebook or something doing social media. I'm paying attention to this presentation, and I love it. So the first hand I have up is Danielle M.
Hi, everybody. Danielle Alcoholic. Thank you to Area 44's History and Archives for such a fantastic presentation. What I was wondering is the colors of the design on the big book covers. You know, 2 and 3 were very similar. 1 is like very bright, and then 4 is kind of, I don't know, it incorporates colors of both. Is there any significance to the design, or was that such a, just a style choice?
So the first book, the dust jacket, was called the circus jacket. And, it, you know, there were actually 2 different types they were looking at originally. 1 was a blue cover that actually said Pathway to a Cure on it. And it had, if I remember right, you know, I'm going through memory, kind of like a depiction of a bottle. And then there was the circus jacket. So I think they ended up picking that one because, you know, they didn't want to use the Pathway to a Cure type 1. And, of course, though, I've heard different people comment on it. So walking down the street with the circus jacket, it was quite bright and colorful, and there was not a whole lot of anonymity walking down the street. And I think you know, they ended up softening it with the 2nd and 3rd, but I've never really seen anything that says, well, this is why we chose this. I'll tell you, the dust jacket on the 2nd and 3rd are quite anonymous, except, of course, for the big text that says Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, they didn't attract a lot of attention. And I can't say why they redesigned it for the 4th. Interesting question, but I don't have any more information on it.
Thank you.
Donald H.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. My name's Donald. I have the privilege of being the archivist for Area 59, Eastern Pennsylvania. And just a side note, on the inside of the dust jacket for the 2nd edition of the big book, it tells you how the dust jacket was designed so that it could be turned, placed inside out. Therefore, you wouldn't have to see what the book was titled. What I wanted to mention was I was doing some research into the Emmanuel movement, and I came across an article by Catherine McCarthy, a PhD, and it says the personal copy of Peabody's book belonging to Bill Wilson, now in the AA archives, contains an inscription. And when I read that, I got in touch with Michelle Mirza, the archivist at GSO. And a week later, I found myself sitting in the archives in her office holding a copy of Peabody's Common Sense of Drinking book. And on the inside of the front cover of that book, it said, presented to the archives of the General Service Office of AA by Rosa Burwell, July 1979. And there was a typed note attached to the front page of it, which said, this is one of the source books which Bill Wilson said was very helpful when our book was being written. Dr. Peabody was, as far as is known, the first authority to state once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and he proved it by returning to drinking and dying of alcoholism, proving to us that disease is incurable. So I just thought it was very interesting. And I asked Michelle if there was any provenance for this book being the personal copy of Bill Wilson. And she said they had no information to prove that. So it was just an interesting sidelight to Common Sense of Drinking. But I thank you again for your presentation. Take care.
Thank you.
Don, good to see you, by the way. So Don mentions that the inscription is from Rosa Burwell. So Rosa was the wife of Jimmy Burwell, who was, you know, along with Hank, the agnostic. So, you know, the story in the 12 and 12 of, you know, the guy who went out drinking and then called asking for help again. And I don't, you got to forgive me. I don't remember the name they used in the 12 and 12, but it wasn't Jimmy's. But Rosa was Jimmy's wife. So it sounds like Rosa gave that book to the archives, and it doesn't sound like that was Wilson's personal copy. And I do remember, you know, hearing about that book being in the archives. I haven't seen it, but it sounds like Rosa donated it to the archives. I don't see how it could have been Bill's if then it ended up in the Burwells' hands.
Thank you, John. Ebonymous or whatever.
Ebaholic. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Eb. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome. If you've been around a while, thank you. God, have me be where you'd have me be. Say what you'd have me say and do what you'd have me do, despite of me. Because if I'm given an opportunity, I'll mess it up. Thank you guys for all the historical facts and you know, carekeeping. Your stewardship is amazing. I've been a member of a historical brotherhood here on the West Coast. I'm a member of the Into Action Fellowship in Fairfield, California. And I've been a member of that brotherhood far longer than I've been sober. I'm thanking God that I'm sober today. I'm going to leave my telephone number in the chat after I get done sharing. And my goal in doing that is anyone who has any records of where I might find the motorcycle that Bill Wilson and Louise took on a trip. That is like one of my spiritual goals, is to find that motorcycle. I found a suitable substitute to my drinking. You know, I'm a biker. So I'm going to leave my number, and I thank you all for any knowledge on the road to, you know, finding this journey of mine. Appreciate your time and super awesome presentation.
Thank you. I may have a picture of the motorcycle with Bill and Lois in it. I know that exists, but I don't know where you might find that, but that would be cool, man. Let us know. Ross's iPad.
Thank you, Greg. My name is Ross, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Early Bird Group in Aurora, Colorado. Early in the presentation, there was a reference to Bill addressing a medical society in New York in 1944. And if I'm not mistaken, there used to be, and I think it was recently discontinued, a pamphlet on that Bill addresses to medical societies. One, I think, was in Montreal, and maybe the other was in New York. And I wanted to know if that was the reference from that, and why was it decided to discontinue that pamphlet?
So Bill gave 3 talks to the medical societies, and yes, there was a pamphlet. I remember it being discussed, should they discontinue it? I don't know if they did. I know that, you know, that is a fantastic pamphlet, and, you know, a lot of people don't look at it. If anybody were to want it, I have it in PDF copy. And at the end of the presentation, I'll give you my email address. If anybody wants it, they can email me and I'll send it. But some of the text that we actually used in the slide came right out of that pamphlet. So we were quoting Bill Wilson in his talk in that 1944 address to the Medical Society of New York. And to just go back to the gentleman who asked to find the bike. So because we're talking about the books behind the book, and I'm not saying this is a book behind the book, but Lois kept a diary for most of her life. But during the time they took that motorcycle trip in 25 and 26, she kept all that in the diary, and it was later published as a book called The Diary of Two Motorcycle Hobos. I don't think that's available anymore, and I don't even think you could find the electronic version on the web because there was a lawsuit regarding that. But if you can ever get your hands on the Diary of the Motorcycle Hobos, it's a great story, Lois kept, you know, of the daily happenings where they
were on the title.
That. Yeah. And I think I have it right. The Diary of the Two, it's either the Two Motorcycle Hobos or the Motorcycle Hobos. I have it on my computer, of course. I'd have to look it up, but, look up Motorcycle Hobos. If you Google it, I'm sure you would find it. The references to the book anyway.
Someone posted on the chat some kind of a link about motorcycles. So I don't know if it may be that, but check out the chat and copy that link and see. Christine and Tanner, hi Christine and the islands there, wherever you are.
Hey, I'm going to butt in really fast. I see it on eBay for $125 right now.
What's the exact title?
A Diary of Two Motorcycle Hobos.
The Diary of Two Motorcycle Hobos.
Yeah, and it's really a great read. If you can get your hands on it, you know, gives a wonderful view of Bill and Lois in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Bill had periodic sobriety at that time. But there's actually one story where Bill disappears for 3 days and Lois is beside herself. Who's next?
Hold on a sec. Christine.
Thanks so much, Craig. Thanks, Joan. Thanks, everybody, for an absolutely wonderful, wonderful presentation. And it was really interesting to find out more about the books behind the books. Now, a burning question I have had for a long time, I hope it's appropriate here, is that could somebody tell me who was the theorist, who was the psychologist responsible for our beautiful theory, psychological theory of the human being, the human self having these instincts, three God-given instincts for society, security and companionship, relationship? Who do we applaud for that wonderful theory? Because it's amazing. And I've just wondered if anybody could tell me who was responsible for that.
So, you know, obviously when Bill wrote the big book and it was published in 1939, he only had four, you know, maybe going on 5 years of sobriety at the time. And, you know, as we've shown the books behind the book, so Bill really took lots of ideas from different places and kind of put them in the one pot and stirred it up, and we came up with the big book. And I really love the way Joe and Charlie kind of tell the story that then over the next 14 or 15 years, between the time the big book was published and then the 12 and 12 had come out, Bill had really learned a lot more about spirituality and psychology. So when you talk about the basic instincts of life that Bill then so well articulated in the 12 and 12, he had come under so many influences over that 15-year span. You know, he had actually taken, you know, so Father Dowling was a major influence on Bill Wilson. Sam Shoemaker had been a major influence on Bill Wilson. And Sam Shoemaker, by the way, published 31 books. And if you were to read some of Sam's writings, you're going to see how Sam was a tremendous influence behind the scenes on AA, because much of what Sam wrote, Bill took again and then kind of streamlined into his writings. And I think in AA Comes of Age, Bill actually says, you know, all the principles came from Shoemaker and nowhere else. And that wasn't just Bill being kind to Shoemaker. When you read Shoemaker's books, you can see that is where the principles came from. But Father Dowling was a big influence on Bill Wilson. As the years would pass, other people like Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd were big influences on Bill Wilson. And Bill did a lot of reading. He read a lot of spiritual books. Despite some people saying Bill was not a reader, Bill was a reader. Lois had said that. And he picked up a lot of great stuff, and then he was able to put that into the 12 and 12. So a lot of big book people don't like the 12 and 12. Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm a big book person. I love the 12 and 12 because Bill really did expand. He broadened and deepened our understanding of the 12 steps with the 12 and 12. And Sandy Beach was one who always said, I love the big book and I love the 12 and 12 because one is like the basic text. This is our ABCs. And then the 12 and 12 is like composition writing. So you start with the basics and you grow into the other.
Thanks, John. And to Aunt Christine, that's where Bill talks about those instincts. I think she was asking, did those instinct information, did that come from somewhere? Is that Bill's own understanding?
So I never saw it elsewhere, and I would have to think that is Bill's understanding, and that's what, you know, he had written in the 12 and 12.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. So, you know, I look at the 12 and 12. I take sponsees through the big book precisely, but the 12 and 12, like, has 6 and 7. Very beautiful. I mean, you can't it's absolutely God-inspired, and it could be for all humans. He has such an understanding of the instincts in collision and how they've exceeded their intended purpose. So thank you all. And there's some stuff on the chats. Look at them. There's lots of links and things. Dano.
Yes, thank you. My name is Dano and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
And thank you so much for a wonderful presentation. I was hoping that you could touch on some of the bumps along the road with the copyright of the first and second edition along the way and possibly the third. But my main question is the foreign publications in different languages and the ebooks a part of the total, the 40 million sold in the count, or are those, beyond the numbers of the 40 million that are, is that count like paperbacks in America, or does that include the whole gamut? And what were the, if you could touch on the bumps of the copyright issues they had failed to, I guess, renew or something along the way a couple times. Thank you.
So, Daniel, thanks for that question. So at one point, and I believe it was sometime in the late 70s or the early 80s, they allowed the copyright on the first 164 pages, you know, so the first edition to lapse. And at that point, it was in the public domain and anybody could print, you know, that version of the big book. At some point then, and, you know, to be fair to Alcoholics Anonymous, we were in the business of trying to sober up other alcoholics and, you know, rights to intellectual property and so on, as per our traditions, was really not a priority. And, you know, at some point then the copyright on the second edition lapsed as well. And I think, you know, AA kind of learned a bit of a lesson, from that. So, with the publication of the 75th anniversary, I think the 75th anniversary edition of the first, you know, the first printing, I think we kind of regained some of those intellectual rights, if you will. Regarding the 40 million copies, I can't say whether or not it included those books that were printed in other languages. I'm going to assume that it did, because I think it says, you know, in all formats. So, that information that I had gotten when we first did the presentation, and it says 19,150,000 in all formats. I'm going to assume that included soft covers, editions printed in other languages and so on. But we could ask that question of GSO and try to get some more information.
Yeah, there's some questions in the chat. So those that have questions, you may want to raise your hand and ask them to John personally. I'll try to bring them up if they're not brought up. John M. has his hand up.
Yeah, hi, John, Alcoholic. Thank you guys for doing this. I'm out here in L.A. My question, you know, the subject is books behind the big book. And, you know, maybe you can't answer this. Perhaps you can. I'm just wondering if any of, you know, you, John, or anybody else that was part of the participated in this has any book in front of the big book, you know, written in the past 10 or 20 years that dealing with this subject you would recommend for to read. If you can, I don't know if we want, you can necessarily say that or in chat. I'm just interested if there's a book that you'd suggest. I mean,
you're cutting in and out
of the heart multiple times, and just wondering if there's a new.
You're breaking up a little, John. I don't know if we got it.
I get the drift of John's question. And by the way, just to give credit for this presentation, the books behind the book. So there's an AA historian by the names of James B. I won't say his last name. And he also often went by the name Jim B. So he had done the basis of a pamphlet back in the early 90s. And we took that, we had found that pamphlet some years ago and went out to Jim B and said, Jim, would you mind if, you know, we updated it a little bit and turned it into a presentation? Of course, James, being the selfless historian that he is, said, please, by all means. So he was the one that originally did this. And actually, when we did this presentation for the New Jersey State Convention, and I think it was 2019, we actually printed up new pamphlets. And if you were lucky enough to be one of the first 100 in the room, you got one of these colored pamphlets. There have been a number of publications, some posted on AA History Lovers, of, you know, the 25 or 50 books that are recommended for reading. Glenn Chestnut, who was the moderator of AA History Lovers and has since passed on, published that. So if anybody were to email me, I could probably send you a list of books. I don't think you're going to find too many books in the last 20 years. They were more, you know, books that mirrored closely what AA was saying. And, you know, even though we presented, I don't know, 10 or 15 books in that presentation, that's not to say those were the only books. You know, Bill was a reader and he was a seeker. And as such, he got himself into plenty of different books, different ideas. You know, I think I remember reading Bill was, he said, I'm always a shopper at the spiritual pie counter. So he was always looking for these different ideas, and those that he liked, he talked about and he wrote about.
Thank you, John. And you had mentioned Father Ed. There's a book called The Soul of Sponsorship. I think, did Bill write that? Bill wrote that. That's a beautiful, if you're curious about his spiritual advisor, Father Ed Dowling. It's an amazing book. G or Gee?
Yeah, thanks. I'm G. Thank you. Thank you, John. Great presentation. Really enjoyed it. And I know this is books behind the book, but I think I do know the answer to this, but I just feel like asking you this question, John, because just sound like a very knowledgeable man. But what did Bill take from the temperance movement, the Washingtonians, And Dr. Carl Jung wasn't really mentioned today. And if you can expand on that, please, John, that'd be great. And also, is it true that the stories in the back of the big book were changed because those people relapsed? So they put in different stories?
So that's a great question. You have multiple parts, and I'll try to remember each one. So first with the Washingtonians, I think the biggest thing that Bill learned from them was what not to do. So the traditions really talk about how, you know, we need to focus on just one thing, and that's alcoholism. One of the downfalls of the temperance movement was that, you know, they were all over the place. They got involved in all kinds of other issues. And anyone could sign the pledge and join the movement. You didn't have to be an alcoholic. So while the Washingtonians were up there and at one point they had 100,000 or more people, they faded quickly because they didn't stay unified, right? So here's our first tradition, you know, our common welfare comes first. So the Washingtonians got involved in other issues. And this is why, you know, AA says we have no opinion on outside issues, which is very, very important. You also asked about, I'm sorry, just come back and tell me your other two parts of your question.
Yes. So, yeah, Dr. Carl Jung wasn't mentioned. And I feel he must have had a big contribution to this book also. And the stories in the back of the big book, did they change because those members relapsed? Because there's a story in the third edition, I think it's the Mi'kmaq Indian, which quite some of my fellows over here really enjoy that story. So do they take the stories out because they relapsed and Dr. Carl Jung, Dr. Carl Jung's contribution? Yeah. Please, John.
So Carl Jung's contribution was tremendous. And I'm going to tell you, Carl Jung had also written two books in the 30s that it would be hard for me to believe Bill wasn't reading. Because, you know, once Bill learned the story of Roland Hazard and Jung's involvement, and that meant so much to Bill, it meant so much to Bill that he told the whole story in the big book, right? So he was very, very impressed by Carl Jung. And, you know, in 1961, he wrote to Carl Jung. But Jung published two books in the 30s. One was called Psychology and Religion. And it's a very, very powerful book. I recommend you read it. And the other one was Modern Man in Search of a Soul. And in both of those books, you're going to find ideas about spirituality having the power to change men's lives. And, you know, the big book is following the same theme, that you're not going to get sober on some other idea. It was spirituality that could do the job. Now, regarding the stories from the first edition, and here's a piece of history that disappears. It's like that pamphlet. If it's no longer published, it's too bad because AA history dies with that. But the second edition, around page, what would have been 168, it was an unnumbered page, Bill talks about it. And Bill kept a first edition that's up at Stepping Stones right now, where he wrote what I'll call as a scorecard. He wrote the results and the outcomes of the 29 stories. So in the big book, there were 30 stories, including Bill's story. But one of the stories was, you know, The Alcoholic's Wife, written by Marie Bray. So there were 29 alcoholic stories. And in this second edition, this unnumbered page, Bill gives the results. And like I said, there's a scorecard written in one of his first editions. And he says, as of 1955, it's a pleasure to report that 15 out of the 29 sobered up on the first shot and never drank again until they died. Another 7 sobered up after a relapse or two. So that's 22 out of 29. And if you remember what it says in the foreword to the second edition, it says, you know, AA grew by leaps and bounds, and 50% who came got sober at once and never drank again. And another 25% after a relapse or two, sobered never to drink. That gave AA a 75% success rate. And Joe and Charlie talk about it. So the proof is in Bill Wilson's first edition book that's up in Stepping Stones. So 22 out of 29 is a little over 75%. So out of those first edition authors, the recovery rate was 75%. There were 7 people that relapsed. So they didn't change the stories because most of them relapsed. And by the way, there was a lot of relapsing going on in the 40s with people that were coming in. But those people whose stories appeared in the first edition, 75% of them recovered and stayed recovered. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, John. Excellent. Thanks, John. Dave, New York City.
Oh, hi. Thank you for calling me. I just want to know a little more about Tom Powers, because 12 and 12 is referenced, and the other person who I forget the name who contributed to the writing of the 12 and 12, and which parts. I'm not sure you can answer the last part of that two-fold question.
So Tom Powers was an early AA member from New Jersey. He came in and got sober sometime in 1940, he was one of the founding members of the Bergen County Group. And, you know, Tom and Bill became good friends. So Tom Powers and a woman by the name of Betty Love helped Bill write the 12 and 12. So, you know, there are interviews with Tom Powers where he talks about it. And, you know, to hear it from Tom, so they were the main editors and they did most of the writing. I can only tell you that in reading the 12 and 12, I see a lot of Bill. And I don't think there's anything anywhere that's going to say, well, Bill wrote this and Tom wrote that and Betty wrote that. I think it was a collaborative effort. And, you know, for those of us that have really enjoyed the spirituality of the 12 and 12, it's a marvelous book. But some of the original ideas of AA, you know, so I'll say they broadened and deepened, which is what Bill says in the foreword to the 12 and 12. He says the purpose of this text is to broaden and deepen our understanding of the earlier work. So I think it was marvelous. They did a great job with it. You know, for those of you that know, not long after that, Tom Powers and Bill had a falling out, and there's different thoughts or reasons behind that. Different historians have different opinions regarding what happened. So I'll kind of leave it. It's all out there on the internet. Just everybody, I'll caution about the internet. Not everything you read on the internet is true. There is a lot of misinformation and myth regarding AA. You know, I think as time goes, more will be revealed. I don't claim to have all of the answers and all of the knowledge. I've been, you know, corrected many, many times. And, you know, what I share is basically the understanding that most historians have at this point. Sometimes I'll put my own little spin on it. You'll forgive me for that. I recognize I do that occasionally. So hopefully that answered your question, Dave.
Thank you, John. Just a correction. I got two responses on solo sponsorship, but more than one told me that it was written by Robert Fitzgerald. Someone said Ernie Kurtz, but I don't think so. So Robert Fitzgerald, Society of Jesuits, not Bill W. Okay, let's see here. We've got Joel M. in Miami.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My problem is Joel. I have a question about the manuscript. I understand that the manuscript, which was reprinted in the book that started it all, which I highly recommend reading, which shows all the changes that were made right before the actual printing of the first edition. But my question is, could somebody explain or give a short summary of the litigation between AA and the owners of that manuscript? Because what happened, my understanding is, that the manuscript was first offered to Alcoholics Anonymous before it was actually, you know, reprinted as a book by Hazelton. And AA turned it down because it was an outside issue. And then later on, apparently, AA woke up and said, oh, my gosh. And then, there was a whole lawsuit fairly recently about that. And I just don't really hear much about that ever. And I'd be very curious to hear a little more background on that lawsuit and why it was then instituted after turning it down and then, you know, how it ended up the way it did.
So that's a really interesting question. And this is a fairly complicated and in-depth story, but I'll try to go through it quickly. So one of the early members, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard of him, is Barry Leach. So Barry was an early member. He is probably the first openly gay member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so this has been well written about, so I'm not breaking Barry's anonymity. Now, Barry ended up authoring the book Living Sober. Okay. And Living Sober had been worked on by a couple of people. Living Sober was originally meant to be kind of a toolbox for old timers. And, you know, the book, the writing wasn't going well. So finally Barry said, okay, you know, he made a deal with General Service to take a crack at the book. And I think Barry was paid $4,000 for his authorship. And that Living Sober became such a popular book. It was probably, you know, the second most printed book in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe the third behind the 12 of 12. But Barry went back to World Services and said, I'd like a royalty for the book. And AA told him no. And Barry was going to sue AA. So Barry and Lois were very, very close. And Lois owned the original manuscript, what we will call the printer's copy. So that was not in the hands of the AA archives. Lois owned it. So I think Lois went to Barry and said, look, Barry, why don't you drop the lawsuit and I'm going to give you this wonderful gift. So she did. And Barry dropped the lawsuit. And what Barry did then was he said, okay, and he actually willed it back to AA upon his death. And Barry was recorded saying, you know, I'm in possession of this wonderful piece of AA history, but I'm merely the custodian of it. Upon my death, my will says it goes back to AA. And the funny thing is kind of like that first edition copyright where nobody was minding the store. When Barry died, nobody was minding the store. And Barry's nephew came into possession of the manuscript. And it was Barry's nephew that first put it up for auction. And I'm going to think this was sometime in the 80s. I'd have to go back and look up the timeline. But, you know, it first sold for well over $1 million. Eventually then that original buyer auctioned it off again and Ken Roberts came into possession of it. So it was Ken that then took it to Hazelton and produced the printer's copy. Now when Ken went to sell the manuscript again, that's when AA got involved and said, okay, they filed a lawsuit to kind of stop it because AA now came back into the possession of the knowledge that, wait a minute, this was willed to us long ago. Well, the problem is, you know, the horse left the barn long ago. Ken Roberts paid well over $1 million for the book. So you can't just suddenly say, well, now, Ken, you have to turn it over to us. So there were so many issues. Now AA is getting involved in lawsuits and lawyers, seemingly not in keeping with the traditions. So I can't tell you the inside thinking why they decided to drop the lawsuit. I think it was probably the right thing to do. I think, and this is only my personal opinion, but if AA wanted to come back into possession of that manuscript, they would have had to have bought it from Ken, because Ken needed to be made whole. Ken was innocent in that. You know, he didn't buy the manuscript knowing, hey, this was AA's. It was Barry's nephew that first committed the first sin, you know, if we should say that. But it is what it is. So it was never rejected by AA. So that piece is wrong. AA just was asleep at the switch. When Barry died, somebody should have said, wait a minute, Barry's got the manuscript and he willed it to us. That would have been the point to get a hold of it. I would love to see that manuscript back in AA's possession. It really belongs in the archives. And maybe someday someone will buy it who has the wherewithal then to donate it to AA. And, you know, whether or not that would violate the traditions, I don't know. And I don't like to use that word violate, but whether or not that would go against the traditions, because it is a very valuable commodity at this point, having been sold for well over $1 million. So I hope that gives you the story.
Well, you filled in the gaps, because I heard Ken speak about this at the history meeting on Friday nights, and he gave the whole story. And the only thing different from what you, well, you've added stuff. So now at least I understand why they rejected it. But they actually did reject it. Ken said that Hazleton, they made a point of going to AA and saying, you know, would they do it? And it was only when AA said, no, it's an outside issue. Now you're explaining that they never even knew at that time that they owned it. So that changes the way they came to that conclusion, obviously. So that, but they actually did, you know, they did try. And Ken, you're right, he's absolutely a bona fide purchaser, because he was innocent totally, and therefore he would clearly at that point have been the legal owner, period. So they would have lost that lawsuit, in my opinion. I'm an attorney. They would have lost that lawsuit in the long run.
Well, anyway. Yeah, because the bell had been rung, right? Yeah. So I guess that would be the way to say it.
Thank you. You filled in the missing link as to why. Now this explains with that part about not ever knowing, you know, why it happened the way it did. Thank you.
And yeah, I was invited to a Facebook group that's like the legalese behind the AA. And for a while, they were debating about the buying of it. But they seem to have dropped it since then. There was a lot going on. So like John just said, it seems though they realized. And maybe someone just put up on the chat that an owner of a team or something bought it for $2 million. And maybe someone in their heart that can afford it will at least bequeath it to AA eventually or whatever. But great. Thank you for asking that, Joel. Nancy.
Hi, everybody. Nancy, alcoholic from South Jersey. Loving this information. I just have a quick question. It's a two-part short question. Why was the triangle and circle removed from the big book, and when did that happen? Thank you.
So there is a document out there. I'm trying to remember. Something tells me Charlie Bishop did it. Charlie Bishop was the bishop of books. And it says, whatever happened to the circle and triangle? So, you know, obviously the coin business became a big business. I don't know. I'm going to guess it was the 70s, the 80s, certainly the times of the 28-day rehab. Coins were big. And, you know, AA never got into the coin business. So the idea of the circle and the triangle, AA in the 90s, it could have been the late 80s, but I'm going to say the early 90s, they believed that they were the owner of the trademark or the logo, which included the circle and the triangle. So they actually, in their infinite wisdom, and yeah, we alcoholics do some screwed up stuff occasionally, and GSO will do some screwed up stuff occasionally. They went out and started to sue, file lawsuits against some of these coin dealers, if you will. And a couple of them actually stopped, but there was one that stood up to GSO and said, "The hell with you, we'll go to court." And they began to present evidence that the circle and the triangle was around long before Alcoholics Anonymous was. There's references in history to this logo or similarities. So AA was going to lose the lawsuit, and I'm not sure if they actually lost it or they were going to, but they dropped it. And having now said, okay, it's not our logo, and this is my take on it, you may disagree, but it's like, okay, I'm taking my marbles and going home. And AA then stopped using the circle and triangle in all the literature. So all the literature was, you know, the circle and the triangle denoted that this was conference-approved literature. So they stopped using the circle and triangle altogether. And it's too bad, because in St. Louis, Bill gave a wonderful talk about the circle and the triangle and what it meant to us spiritually. But it was sometime in the early 90s that AA decided, so not only are we not going to use the circle and triangle anymore, we're going to drop it from all the literature. It's too bad. I hope one day the circle and the triangle comes back. You know, we can generously share it with everybody that claims some spiritual connection to it. And why wouldn't we? Because we don't get involved in property, or we shouldn't. But that's what happened. We got involved in property.
Thank you, John. Great stuff. Debbie L, Y and H Group.
Hi, everybody. Debbie Alcoholic. Thank you, Craig, and Prime Time for putting this on. It's wonderful. And Area 44 in New Jersey. I have a question for a friend who had to go to work, Astrid. She wanted to know if you could expand on Bill and LSD. Thank you.
I could. And by the way, I hope everybody sees these little chat boxes that are appearing. You know, we have so many wonderful people that are able to Google something and then come in with some additional information. And for those of you that are doing that, thank you. I saw one that just said Bill talked about it in 55 at the convention. And Bill says it didn't originate with us. And, you know, so the funny thing is, in the 1990s, GSO should have remembered that talk before they went and kind of filed the lawsuit against the coin makers. So LSD and Bill Wilson. And earlier on, I mentioned Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd. And, you know, Huxley was a wonderful philosopher, and so was Gerald Hurd. If you ever get a chance to read Huxley's 1946 book called The Perennial Philosophy, what a marvelous book. But the February 46 or 47 grapevine mentioned Huxley's book. But anyway, it was Gerald Hurd that introduced Bill to these two Canadian doctors that was studying LSD and alcoholics. And they reached out to Bill Wilson and said, you know, we think we have this new drug that can help alcoholics. So Bill agreed to participate in some of the experiments. And a lot of this is misconstrued and misunderstood. Oh, my God, Bill's dropping acid. Well, you know, LSD back then was an experimental drug. You know, it had been invented, if I remember right, by these German scientists. And it was a powerful drug, and they were trying to find its niche. So Bill agreed to join in the studies, and he took LSD under these controlled experiments. So it's not like, okay, Bill, here's a tab, go home and put on your favorite record. They were giving him the drug, and others were taking it, like Lois and you know, maybe Father Dowling and some of these other folks were all trying it. And Bill wanted to try to help the alcoholics that the ego was very strong in, right? So sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So anybody that had this sudden type of religious experience, you know, the ego is broken down. This is the deflation of depth. But there were some who could never surrender. And Bill was hoping that perhaps LSD or something else could help those folks that AA just couldn't seem to help. So Bill was ever trying to find anything that could help alcoholics. You know, later on, there was a lot of controversy over Bill and his recommending of the vitamin niacin. And it's the same thing. And there was a lot of heated action regarding Bill's endorsing. And a lot of people at the time were criticizing Bill over the LSD stuff. You know, we alcoholics are very opinionated. So anything we disagree with, we're going to speak out against. But I could tell you Bill's motives in that was to try to help other alcoholics. By the time 59 rolled around, I think Bill had concluded that, you know, it wasn't quite what we had hoped for. But he participated in the experiments, the medically supervised experiments, for a number of years in the hope of trying to help alcoholics who just couldn't be helped. So that's what it was. Bill was ever looking for anything that could help that group that just doesn't seem to benefit from anything else. So I, you know, it wasn't Bill was getting high, dropping acid or anything like that. It was all very, very controlled. And I'm going to tell you, I've recently read articles that says this type of study is coming back. So they are still experimenting with, psychotropics to help schizophrenic people, alcoholic people, addicted people, and who knows? Time will tell. They may find some benefit in LSD or other psychotropic drugs that can help these addicted people. So more as they learn about addiction, and wouldn't we all be surprised if Bill in the end is proven right and something along those lines comes that is able to break down the ego in the addicted person to the point where they can have some type of spiritual awakening.
Thank you, John. Yeah, there is microdosing now, especially helping PTSD for like ex-combat veterans and stuff. There's a lot of hope in that. So yeah, and also on the vitamin niacin B3. I take in high doses. There is an article. I don't have it offhand. But if you Google Bill Wilson niacin B3, and there was a doctor, and it's a very interesting article. When I was at the archives in Akron, the other members of, oh, there's Bill again on one of his things. But he wanted to bring it to AA as a very important thing. And I thought it was another one of his crackpot ideas. But there may be some validity. It's just something to consider for those that suffer from depression, like Bill and myself. Anyway, G, did you already? Was that your hand?
Yeah, I did. Sorry, I'm gonna sneak. Sorry, I'm sneaking in again one last time. Sorry, John. But John, I wanted to. Who came up with step four? The columns, putting pen to paper, and the idea of doing. Because someone said in the comments it's Oxford Group step three, but. Yeah, I want to know, where did that come from? The idea of we put it in columns, our resentment, what they hurt, what it affects, and all of that, because it sounds like it's psychology sort of therapy, you know.
So the idea of doing an inventory came straight out of the Oxford group. But I'm going to tell you, it was probably, you know, biblical in nature way before that. But in one of the books that we showed, When Man Listens, God Speaks, they go through in that book how you've got to do an inventory. And in James Allen, As a Man Thinketh, it talks about we are a garden and you've got to get the weeds out. So again, all these great spiritual ideas have commonality in many different writings. So now where did the idea come for columns is what you're asking. So in the beginning, before the big book came out, you know, it seemed to be that steps 4 and 5 were more of let's sit down and go through this process. So in the second and third edition of the big book, you have Earl Treat's version of how he sat on Dr. Bob's porch one afternoon and went through steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, right? So, and I'm having a senior moment. I don't remember what Earl's story was titled. I know someone's going to pop up with a box and in the chat and say it. But, you know, so it seemed to be a verbal process earlier on. And then Bill, in the big book, he sold himself short. So that was Earl's story, and thank you for that. But the idea of the columns sure seems it comes right out of Bill. So that seems like Bill and maybe the New York folks were doing that at the time. So there you have then the basis of either what you'll call the 3 or the 4 column inventory. But he says, you know, Bill says we have to get down to causes and conditions and we put pen to paper. So, you know, I agree with that 100%. I do a 4-column inventory. I do it with any of my sponsees and kind of works beautifully.
Yeah. On that story, you know, there's a recording on our website. It's probably the last recording of Dr. Bob. And he said he did something like the steps. He wasn't like a toss. He stayed with the original Oxford groups. So that page you talked about, Earl Treat, what is it? 263. Where the 6 steps are mentioned, I think that's what they did that day. And there was, you know, 6 and 7 was basically getting on their knees. Bill called, Dr. Bob called them out on it or something like that. So there's kind of 2 kinds of AA, the old Dr. Bob way, which was the original Oxford group way. And then Bill came up. I mean, we're thankful for Bill because he was a complicated guy. He was the seeker that kept wanting more and Bob wanted him to keep it simple, you know, and all that stuff. Anyway, thank you so much, John. Kim P.
Thanks, Craig. Kim Alcoholic. Thanks so much for doing this. This is so interesting. My grand sponsor is here, and she's not able to ask, so I'm asking for her. She's curious about the 24-hour-a-day book and the book God Calling. Are they... you know, did they use the God Calling book for the 24-hour-a-day book? Is it related?
So the 24-hour book, the little black book, is sometimes it's referred to. So that was written by an early AA member by the name of Richard Walker. And, God Calling, I think, was written by the 2 sisters, the 2 listeners, and they are related. So Richard Walker actually, when he put together the 24-hour book, and I love the 24-hour book, when I was in the rehab, of course, they gave me both the big book and the 24-hour book. But Richard Walker gave the 24-hour book or authored the 24-hour book to AA. And apparently AA thought it was a little too, whether you want to say spiritual or religious, it was very much Oxford groupish. And so is God Calling, very much Oxford groupish. And like Craig was just saying, so, you know, the Akronites, the Clevelandites, they really never let go of a lot of the Oxford group. whereas New York and Bill did. So AA ended up turning it down. And I'm going to tell you, behind the big book, the 24-hour book is the most published book. It's even published in greater numbers than the 12 and 12. And I love the spirituality of the 24-hour book. And it could be that, you know, Bill at that time, and maybe for years to come, wanted to continue to set the tone for Alcoholics Anonymous. So while Bill was alive, nothing ever got published in Alcoholics Anonymous that Bill didn't write. So yes, The Grapevine was written, you know, by a group of AA members, and all of the conference approved literature was written by different AA members and then brought to the conference for editing and approval. But the only books that came from AA were written by Bill up until the time of his death. And as I mentioned before in talking about Barry Leach, they had a hard time writing Living Sober. And I'm going to tell you, since then, except for Came to Believe, I don't believe there's been another book published by Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been attempts to publish a history book. Now, with the exception of course, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and Pass It On, no other books have been published by Alcoholics Anonymous that have to do with program. One of the general managers of General Service tried to publish a history book, and the conference couldn't approve it. I can't see the conference all coming together to agree upon a book that would relate to either program or AA history at this point, because it's just so hard to get that many people to agree. That's just my own opinion.
Yeah, according to Joe and Charlie, it almost broke up the AA when Bill presented. They're like, why 12, Bill? We've been using six steps just fine. And all the changes in his original one. And finally he put his foot down and said, I'm either doing it from here out or I'm not doing it. Right. So that's according to Joe and Charlie. Just so you all know, we had about 250 people on here and we still have 174. That's how great this is. Thank you, John. It's so beautiful. Bobby K.
Hey everyone. I'm Bobby. It's nice to be here. I'd like to get back to LSD. I read some excerpts from, well, recording. Doctors had recorded some of the things that Bill said the first time he took LSD, and it was kind of comical. He said he was never going to smoke a cigarette again, and then 10 minutes later he asked for a cigarette. But then he said, people take themselves too damn seriously. And I was wondering if that's where we got our rule number 62, don't take yourself so damn seriously. But in addition to that, I tried LSD when I was 16, 17, and it did amazing things for my psyche. And my father was mentally ill at the time, which is why I left home so early. And I remember thinking, if they could only use this for him, I think it would save him. But I mentioned that to him once. He got in all kinds of trouble because it was the Nixon war on drugs era, and that had become a drug that was war was waging upon. So, but that rule number 62 thing stuck with me. I was wondering if anybody knew if that's where it came from.
So rule 62, and actually it was Michelle in the archives a few years back had found, the roots of that, and, you know, there was had been some discussions on AA history lovers, but Rule 62 was the West Charleston, Virginia group, and you had this super promoter, and they made a mess of things, and it was them that said, wasn't Bill that said, it was them that said, the lesson we learned was, you know, don't take yourself too seriously. So I'm sure Bill, as you mentioned, so somebody had written when he took LSD, he said that. So it's just coming back from, you know, the Rule 62 thing. And again, I'm going to give you my, I'll give you all my email address now. So if anybody were to email me, I could send them that document on Rule 62. But it's bbsgsong@aol.com. So that's the acronym of Big Book Study Group, South Orange, New Jersey. I'll say it one more time. bbsgsong@aol.com. And anybody that emails me anything regarding anything in the presentation today, I'll be happy to answer. And anytime anyone is so inclined that they want to reach out or ask a question, you know, I'm of service to AA by virtue of anything I know about history or the program. So I'm always thrilled to communicate with any of you.
Thank you, John. If somebody got that and can post that on the chat, because Howard's going to keep the chats. I didn't know we could do that and post them as well, so that all these extra little things will be available.
Obviously, just to say really quickly, Craig, that we'll be editing out the last names from the chat.
Okay.
For so anonymity purposes.
Wow. Well, thank you, Howard. That's awesome. We can do it. We've got a few more, and I'll have a few more. Somebody asked if I wanted to ask. Howard, did you want to ask a question at all?
No, I'm sitting here enjoying this very much, but yeah, I'll let other people ask the questions.
Henry, New York City.
Yeah, I'm coming. Give me a second. Yeah, I want to be able to show my picture, my face. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that the woman that talked about LSD before me, it's like exactly kind of segue. It was perfect. Because I was traveling and I heard on NPR, a gentleman was talking about how LSD is now being used again and how during the Nixon era it was taken out and how they're using it medically to help a lot of people who are on addiction as well as suffering from other aspects of mental illness, PTSD. Forgive me if I'm a little nervous, so... I'm glad the service that you're giving and that, those who were like Bill was, who was depressed and that it would break the loop. You could use it to break that loop that they would go through. And, but then they had to find a form of treatment, you know, that would work other than continually using a drug, like a 12-step program or, you know, therapy or something that would offer them an off ramp, more or less, he was saying, and that it was coming back, like she was saying, it's going to be reinstituted to be used medically again, like you were mentioning. And I didn't hear the whole thing from the beginning, but this is great. Thank you so much. I love history. I was on one Sunday for 4 hours. You know, I'm just really love the history, period. I'm just a history buff. Thank you so much for your service. Thanks.
Thanks, Henry. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. JP.
Yeah, JP Alcoholic. Just wanted to claim my seat. Thank you very much for this amazing meeting. I'm a history buff, so I wanted to ask John a question. From a historical point of view, during the creation of the big book and the main books that you mentioned at the beginning, could you describe the religious composition of the members that created those books? I mean, were there a lot of involvement from the Jewish community, Irish Catholics, Protestant, Roman Catholics, and so on? And the other question is if you can expand a little on the creation, the beginning of the, as Bill sees it, if you can narrate how it came about. Thank you.
So the first question, you know, so it kind of stems from the days of the Oxford group. And, you know, so the Oxford group under the leadership of Frank Buchman, who was a Lutheran minister, we're trying to practice the simple principles or tenets, if you will, of simple Christianity. So the Oxford Group was really a Protestant movement, and it was liberal. In fact, you know, if you were a religious historian, they classified it as classic liberal Protestantism. So it was in opposition to like the Calvinism type hellfire and brimstone. Instead, classic liberal Protestantism was very, very open. And so this is where I think the idea of spiritual versus religious, you know, has its roots. So in the early days of AA, it was very much a Christian movement because it came out of the Oxford Group, which was, you know, a group of non-denominational. So within the Christian faith, there are many sects and denominations. And Bill points that out in the big book. We're not allied with any sect or denomination. But he could have almost said, but we are a group of Christians. But he didn't say it because he didn't want to bring religion into it. So later, the group from Cleveland were kind of the first Catholics coming into this. And they actually had to break off from the meetings in Akron because the church in Cleveland said, you guys can't be going up to those Protestant meetings. And they actually used the words like, if you keep doing it, we might have to consider excommunication. You got to remember back then, there were great schisms within the Christian religion. And it wasn't until the 60s where they had this kind of reunification where the Catholics and the Protestants, you know, buried their own differences. So then over the years, AA was open to anybody that would come in. It didn't matter what your faith was. I think the only requirement, you know, so they would say the only requirement for membership was the desire to stop drinking. But I think if you read the book, it also says, you know, belief in the power of God was one of the essentials. So although there were a couple of early agnostics, and Hank and Jimmy Burwell being two of them, even Hank in his story says, in the end, I was on my knees with the tears rolling down my face. So I think as long as you were willing to believe in a power greater than yourself, the form of religion you chose to follow didn't matter. And I think AA's take on the whole thing was, look, we just want to bring you back to spirituality. And I think AA took pride in the fact that a lot of the members went back to their original faith of their childhood and returned to their churches or synagogues and were of service. So, you know, I think it's hard to get sober in AA and not get with some of the spiritual aspects of the program. And I think one of the universal aspects is service. You know, you have to be of service to other people. And I think religion at its very core teaches the same thing. They throw a lot of other things on top of it, but at the very core, I think religion is doing the same thing.
Thank you. You know, we have a guy on here, Roy L. He's awesome. And he's been making comments. I know him personally. He's got a lot of knowledge. He's part of a historical group as well. He mentioned about Clarence Snyder. Roy, would you like to share anything? I know you're a very humble guy. He's not raising his hand. Anything you'd like to share before I call on the next question?
Well, I don't know how humble I am, but I appreciated the talk. I've been involved with AA history I'm a long time sober guy. I've been involved with AA history for over 20 years. I've been in touch with guys like Glenn Chestnut and Ernie Kurtz before they died via email. I'd ask them questions. And I've been listening to AA history talks for years. I thought the guys said they did a great job. I have most of the books they mentioned, although they did come up with a couple. You know, you can always learn something. Just stay open. And, I just think, there's some talks by the guys who wrote the book you might want to listen to on the internet. And Clarence Snyder's certainly one of them, where he's got this hilarious talk about how Cleveland AA broke away from the Oxford groups. And, you know, the so-called first century Christians came up to Cleveland Heights and tried to break up their meeting. And, you know, some of, he said, you should have seen these first century Christians. You know, one of them tried to punch me out. Dr. Bob saved me, you know. Dr. Bob was his sponsor. So, yeah, this stuff is great. I don't know. I only study it because I'm interested in using the big book. And I like to, there's a line in the book, the man we picked to be our sponsor should know what we're driving at. You know, it's in the context of the fifth step. And that's why I study AA history. It's not because I'm not fascinated by trivia, but I want to know where this stuff comes from. So a talk like this about the books that came before the big book is, you know, very helpful to me. And I've known about Bishop's List for years. Glenn Chestnut sent it to me, and he said, you got to read at least 60 books to understand the Oxford group's influence on AA. I said, who the hell's got time to read 60 books? But, you know, 20 years later, I've got maybe 20 of them under my belt. So great talk. I just want to thank you for it. And that's all I have to say is thank you, really.
Thank you, Roy. I do a big book study tonight at 7 p.m. on prime time. You know, we read it word by word. And Roy has been a great help. Love when you come and share your knowledge. Bill H. has his hand up. Thanks, Roy. Bill H.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks very much for this presentation. I was hoping that you could give a quick little background on where the Little Red Book fits into all of this. I know that that was published, about 5 years before the 12 and 12.
So thank you for that question. And just before we move on, I think Royale, now that I listen to you and I'm thinking I know your last name, I think you and I have communicated a bit over the years. And if that is you, Roy, thank you. Good to finally hear you. And now the current question regarding the Little Red Book. So that's an interesting one. So the Little Red Book came out in 1946, if memory serves me correctly. And Dr. Bob thought, and some of the Akronites thought, maybe sometimes the big book was a little too complicated for the average Joe, the average blue-collar worker. So two of Dr. Bob's sponsees, Carl Webb. Okay, so Barry Collins and Richard Webb, if I'm thinking correctly. So they wrote the Little Red Book as kind of like a little step study, a 12-step step study. And it became very popular in Akron. And I'm going to tell you, so again, this is my own theory and my own thinking, but, you know, Bill Wilson saw that and then said, oh, now I've got to write my own little step study and, you know, came out with the 12 and 12. And for anybody that says, you know, oh, the Little Red Book is non-conference approved, there was no conference until 1951. And of course, one of their first edicts was, you know, we have to approve all literature. And I laugh sometimes because we were getting sober on a lot of non-AA literature, you know, for a long time. But the Little Red Book came out of Akron, came from Dr. Bob's sponsees. And if it came from Dr. Bob's two sponsees, I could almost say with all certainty it had Dr. Bob's blessing and probably his input as well. So the Little Red Book is more Oxford groupish, if you will allow me that expression. It is certainly very spiritual. So there is no joking around as to, you know, you need to apply spiritual principles and God, if you will, in your recovery. So I love the Little Red Book. My home group certainly does a study of the Little Red Book every few years, as we do. We've done the Sermon on the Mount. We have done As a Man Thinketh. We have done When Man Listens, God Speaks. We have done studies into the varieties of religious experience. Even though we're a big book group, we study a lot of this closely related literature. So that's the story behind the Little Red Book.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We've got a few more hands that keep going up. Are you good with time? It's noon. It's been 2 hours. You're good to hang on for some more?
I'm fine. I'll stay as long as you guys want.
Well, you know, we're a bunch of lushes here. We can't get enough, right? So here we go. Dave, New York, NYC.
Yeah, I'm a history buff too, but it's kind of frustrating. It really is for me. Very confusing. It's a lot. I know a lot of the history is fuzzy. There's so many. I don't really have to figure this stuff out. I just really need to let it like rarely to never. I still hear that at meetings that Bill wanted to. I'm not going to get into that because I know the truth. He did not want to change rarely to never. But I'm still hearing it at meetings. What can I say? I actually heard a talk about it that he did not want to change it. But that's not even what I wanted to share. Right, I did share that. Not to beat a dead horse, but the LSD experiment. I knew all that. You know, under strict supervision, and also to help get out of depression and possibly quit smoking. I heard that. But what I also heard, which is probably not true, but maybe you'll correct me, is I understand LSD is for the death of the ego in those moments. But I also heard that he wanted to expand on his spiritual awakening. Other than taking the 12 steps. This is what I heard. I don't know how true that is. Maybe you can expand on that. Not that we rarely never. You don't have to do that one. Thanks.
So just going back to the LSD. So I think, you know, if we were to phrase it as, Bill was looking to open the spiritual door, not only to himself, but anybody else that could walk through it. So anything that could help bring down some of those human impediments to that type of experience was what Bill was after. So, you know, and if it could help others as well as himself, you know, sure, that was all part of Bill's goal in being willing to participate in that. So I think that should pretty much put the finishing touches on that.
Yeah. Marcia P.
Hi there. This is really wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is wonderful. I'd like to know some history on the Golden Books and Sermon on the Mount. These are books that I was introduced to in my coming into the program 33 years ago. And I'm wondering about those. And I wonder about how did the Reflections book, that particular series, come to take the place of the 24-hour book? Thank you.
So the Sermon on the Mount was written by Emmett Fox, and that's one of the books behind the book. So in the late 30s, Emmett Fox was giving lectures in New York City at Steinway Hall, and early AA members were going to his lectures. So Emmett Fox was one of, you know, the ministries that we'll call as part of New Thought, right? So there was Divine Science, which was one of the three churches of New Thought, and Emmett Fox was part of that. So all of the AAs were reading Sermon on the Mount. So Sermon on the Mount is Matthew chapter 5 in the New Testament. So this is Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, which he turned around and gave the Beatitudes and said, you know, blessed are the peacemakers. And so this goes to the heart of the Oxford Group teaching, new thought. It was, you know, the kind of gentler form of what I will say is religion, as opposed to the old style hellfire and brimstone. So you could see, whereas Alcoholics, the hellfire and brimstone never did much for us, but we were able to get with this kind of gentler religious principle, which we ended up calling spirituality, because Alcoholics still had a problem with the word religion. So I won't get into the spiritual versus religious debate. In my mind, you know, they're both hamburgers. One is a Big Mac and one is a plain hamburger. That's all it is. One's got a lot more than the other. Now, you mentioned the Golden Book. So that was another Jesuit priest by the name of Father Ralph, and I don't know if I'm saying his last name right, Fau, P-F-A, P-F-U. So he wrote these Golden Books anonymously. And I'll be honest, I haven't read the books. I have some of the records. They actually came out on records. But kind of like the Little Red Book, so this was a spiritual study of the steps according to Father Ralph. And you would know better than I know the Golden Books clearly indicate they're written by a priest, I think. And it was Father Ralph. And I think it was in the vein of, you know, the Midwest type AA. And there's a whole huge history of Midwest AA. You know, we were talking about Barry Collins and Richard Webb and the Little Red Book. Hazelden and AA in Minnesota came out of that Midwest AA. Hazelden was very much aligned with Alcoholics Anonymous in those early days. It was AA members that brought it about. So, you know, even though over the years these things had to separate naturally, you know, we're all kissing cousins. Let's just say every one of us can claim Bill Wilson or Ebby is our sponsor, because whoever was sponsored by them sponsored them. And so the lineage of all of us goes back to Bill Wilson and Ebby and the Oxford Group, no matter how you look at it.
Thank you, John. Yeah. Someone just said that Dr. Bob wrote the Red Book with Hazelton. You might have mentioned it. I'm like kind of hosting here and muted. Is that any truth to that?
No. So Barry Collins and Richard Webb are the authors of the Little Red Book.
Okay.
Now, how much Dr. Bob was behind it, we'll never know. And just like you introduced Roy and said, here he is with his humility, it could very well be that the Little Red Book was Dr. Bob's creation and we'll never know it. Like I said, it would be not easy to fathom that Bob didn't play a big part in it. And surely he endorsed or approved everything that went into that book. Otherwise, Collins and Webb would not have wrote it. But that was a study. And, you know, I've seen position papers by GSO over the years. Well, we don't approve of these step studies. The Little Red Book was a step study. It was the first step study that was ever done. So why would we not approve of these little step studies?
Yeah, Dr. Bob did approve it before it was, someone just posted. Yeah, you're awesome, John. And Emmett Fox, you know, I do a meeting right after this at 1:00 and I do one yesterday at noon. And, it is a little controversial. I wrote a format because for those that are literal Christians, they think it's not Christianity. And for those that aren't, that may be agnostic, you know, it's a great introduction into the spiritual principles. It's about what Jesus taught as opposed to the dogma of religion, Ecclesiastes. Like, he was not into that stuff. Any rate, thank you so much. Carla S. in Miami.
Hi, my name is Carla and I live in Miami. And thank you so much for your service. I'm loving this. Speaking of step studies, could you talk about the Back to Basics program, which is that 4-week intensive step study that I heard was required of AA members back in the 1940s before you could even attend an AA meeting. And I've also heard there's been a resurgence in interest of that back to basics, so that newcomers have an opportunity to go through the steps at least quickly once, instead of dragging out taking the steps for a year or longer. So the back to basics program.
So first, let me tell you, I love your background, Carla, that you put up. Thank you for that. And so the back to basics was put together by an AA historian by the name of Wally P. And there is some historical basis that in the beginning, in the early 40s, and I'm saying around 43, 44, 45, a number of groups began to have what was called beginners classes. And, you know, even in Akron, in the earliest days, so if you were to read Dr. Bob, they would say you couldn't go to your first meeting until you made your surrender. So in Dr. Bob's house, they were taking people up to the bedroom and you had to hit your knees. And Joe and Charlie tell the story and it's wonderful. And they kind of ad lib, well, if you didn't surrender good enough, they'd kind of vote on your surrender and make you do it again. So I think there's a little bit of myth to that. And Joe and Charlie were always adding some levity, but it would appear to be true that you were not allowed to join the fellowship until you hit your knees and surrendered. So I think it was Detroit and Washington and then later Minnesota all talked about these beginner classes where they would take the newcomers through the steps in this advanced type program. And so Wally, you know, doing the research as best that he did, put together the Back to Basics program. I went through Back to Basics some years back. I know Wally. I think it's a marvelous way of introducing the newcomer. Wally has certain things that he doesn't want to budge on regarding, well, this is how they did it. You know, so somebody asked before about the four column inventory, and Wally's convinced that nobody did it that way, that there was in fact like this little checklist. So my position is, look, whatever gets you doing the work, is good. And if you want to start off with a verbal fourth step, first goal, like Dr. Bob and Earl Tree did, I think that's fine. If you want to use a simple little checklist, I think that's fine. If you want to do a four column inventory, I think that's fine. I think, you know, we don't do this. It's once through the steps and then we're done. You know, we've arrived. And I think there's many ways to do the steps. Maybe some people will only do a fourth step and a fifth step once in their life, and maybe some people will do it many, many times. I think Wally provides, and the Back to Basics provides, a wonderful avenue for some newcomers. Other newcomers may say, well, that didn't work for me, and that's the beauty of AA, right? So the best thing that I can give you is the big book. That's how I learned. But I recognize the big book won't work for everybody. And this is what Sandy Beach taught me so well in some of the seminars and the recordings I went through with Sandy. You're constantly looking for ways to help people. So like Bill said, I'll try LSD to see if I can help the people that can't be helped. If I'm working with a newcomer and he won't get with the big book, well, I'm not going to say, well, the hell with you. I'm going to try to find what will work with him. And then if he opposes me on everything, you know, the book says sometimes we have to leave people on their own and then they'll come back. You know, we can't spend too much time on one particular case if it's not working. But, you know, that's what Back to Basics does. And some people will say it's a great thing and others may take issue with it. I have done the Back to Basics presentation in my own home group a number of times and a number of people said it helped them. So, and if I can help just one person, I think I'm 100% successful.
That's awesome. Yeah, Roy said he did it 20 years ago and it didn't hurt. John M.
Yeah, John Alcoholic. sorry for double dipping on questions. This is kind of a simple one, and I'm going to leave my video off because I've got a weak internet connection, I believe. It might help for getting this out, the question. My question has to do with Bill and his late in life introduction to TM. And I believe, you know, a year or two, maybe 3 years before he passed, he was introduced to that form of meditation. And I believe he stated, this is a very loose quote of his, but that TM helped him complete his 11th step for the first time in his life. And I'm wondering if, John, you have anything to say about that. And I hopefully this came through. I'm sorry if it
John.
Go off.
Great question.
You know, I recently saw or heard about some postings that had to do with Bill Wilson and TM. And I assume when you say TM, you're talking about transcendental meditation. Yes. So the only thing I could say is, you know, in all of the history readings that I've ever read, I've never seen anything about that. So I can't comment whether it's true or it's not true. I'm going to tell you my instinct, and please don't be offended, but my instinct is saying it could be myth, but that's only because I have never seen anything written about it from any knowledgeable historians. Now, I could be wrong, and maybe, in fact, you know, Bill Wilson is recorded talking about it, and I would love to learn more about it so that when I'm asked the question, I'm speaking from a position of knowledge where I can cite a source. And the thing about myth in AA history, and I'm not saying this is one of them, but, you know, oh, my sponsor told me, or my grand sponsor told this person, and, you know, all the stuff that you see on the internet, there has to be a citation of some source in order for us as historians to consider it fact. And for us, we're really looking for a primary document. So if you showed me a letter that Bill Wilson wrote that talked about, where he talked about his experience with transcendental meditation, so that would be a primary document, okay? A secondary source, but one very close, would be Lois Wilson. If she were to write, or having said in a talk, that Bill was a voracious reader, for example. So that would be a good source. And I'll give you an example of the conflict. So Nell Wing used to say, well, Bill didn't like to read. But yet Lois, and Lois remembers, says Bill was a voracious reader. So my take is early on, Bill did a lot of reading, but got lazier later in life and didn't do a lot of reading. And Nell was a part of Bill's life in the later periods. So, you know, that's how I try to balance those things. I saw one of the chats say there's a big library at the Wilson House. That was not Bill's library, just so you know. So all the books that are up in the, what we're going to call the Griffith Library, were donated by the historian Dick B. So while a lot of those books I'm sure Bill did read, I'm sure there's a lot of books in that library that Bill Wilson never even heard of. So just because they're up in the Griffith Library doesn't mean Bill read them or endorsed them. And by the way, that's not a dig at Dick B. I knew Dick Burns personally and had many a good talk with him. And I agreed with many things that Dick B. said, and I disagreed with a number of things as well. We historians occasionally get rigid in our thinking as well, just so everybody knows.
My take, you know, from reading, and because we do a lot of meetings where we meditate for 11 minutes, a form of transcendental meditation. But to me, Bill W., in the big book, in the 11th step, meditation is retire at night on awakening, you know, inspiration. Because after that next paragraph on 87 says,
after our meditation, we say a prayer, something like this: show me what my next step is to be, and that I be given whatever I need to take care of such problems. Also in the 12 and 12, when he talks about meditating, he brings up the 11th step, the St. Francis prayer, and he's basically contemplating the different lines. And I think for Bill, meditation meant contemplation. What do you think? Is that, you think that's probably more what he meant than TM?
So, you know, Craig, I would agree with you. So Bill's writings regarding meditation were certainly indicative of the contemplative type of meditation. But I would also say in the 12 and 12, Bill is very quick to say, hey, there's as many types of meditation as. So it was a wide open field, and I saw a chat box fly by saying that there was an interview where a guy says, you know, he heard Bill talk about it. So I would just caution that's not enough of a citation, you know, so that would be considered hearsay. So somebody from years past who said, well, I heard Bill talk about it, you know, it may or may not be true. As a historian, I would need a more, let's just say, you know, rock solid citation in order for me to say yes, you know, and to speak of it as a historian. So just that somebody said, I heard Bill talk about it, it's just
right.
Not yeah, enough. Not yeah, enough.
I appreciate that. That's great. We have a couple hands that keep coming up. It's Steve R. And Steve, I want to thank good Steve.
Yeah, hi, Craig and John and the whole group. Thank you so much for your presentation. This is kind of following along the lines of what Craig was talking about. And I have been experimenting with and trying to learn more about two-way prayer. And I keep hearing that it is what the Oxford group practiced. I keep reading little bits in the big book every now and then where I hear the words prayer and meditation. Prayer and meditation. Ask God. Listen. And it would seem to me that maybe that was kind of always the intent, that I don't pray on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and meditate Tuesday, Thursday and Sunday, but that it was supposed to be a continuous action. Do you have anything you can shed on that as far as Oxford group history and early AA use of it? Thank you, John.
So the Oxford group practiced what was called quiet time. And there is a lot of it written in the various Oxford group books. And, you know, so one of the best books is one of the ones we showed you, which said, when man listens, God speaks. So the funny thing is when we're praying, and praying could take numerous forms. It could be petition type prayer. Right? God, you know, I'd be happy if you gave me this. Or we're praying for other people, but we're petitioning. It could be contemplative, where we are kind of thinking about something we've read. It could be ritualistic, where we're repeating, you know, set phrases. But the whole idea of prayer and meditation or quiet time with the Oxford group was that at one point I need to shut up. Because if I'm speaking, what am I definitely not doing? I'm not listening. So the idea was, you know, when man listens, when we got quiet, God would speak. So that's that little intuition, that intuitive thinking that Bill talked about in the big book in the 12 and 12. When we get quiet, the Oxford group said, God would give us some instructions or some intuitive thought. And how many times in your meditation has the idea come, you know, I need to do this, or maybe I should do that. Maybe I should reach out to this person. The Oxford group actually recommended in your quiet time that you have a paper and pencil, because the flood of ideas, the intuitive thinking would come quickly. And we should write down what these thoughts are, because we wouldn't remember all these things. So Wally also wrote a book, and if I'm remembering, I'm getting so old, was the name of the book, The Guidance of God. But Wally's book regarding two-way prayer. So this is the same Wally we're talking about in the back to basics. I can probably look on my bookshelf and find the book over here. But, you know, again, it goes back to the book by Cecil Rose, When Man Listens, God Speaks. So we were to have our contemplative prayer and then get quiet and listen. And when, you know, when we would listen, God would speak to us. And he would give us definite direction. And my own take, having practiced this and followed it for years, when you do what God tells you to do, the voice gets louder and clearer. But when you, oh, that can't be God telling me to do that. Well, he can't be telling me to go say I'm sorry to that person who was so wrong. And then when you don't do it, the voice seems to get quieter. So two-way prayer is right there for all of us, and it's prayer and meditation. Absolutely.
Thank you. And I want to thank Steve. Mm-hmm. He's who I helped me find you. He found Frank. And this is because I had seen the presentation and I didn't copy your email address from that other one. And I wasn't able to stay with for the whole Q&A because I do another meeting after, but, awesome. And so thank you, Steve, for going to that effort. This is a beautiful thing. Felix E.
Hey, John, Felix E, alcoholic. And John, thank you so much. I really enjoyed so much that I've heard. You know, I'm sorry I missed the first hour, but I'm totally grateful that it has been recorded, and I can't wait to hear the first hour. So I hope my question was not answered during the first hour, but I actually lived pretty close to Stepping Stones in New York, and the first thing that blew me away were all the books that were there, and then I just sent the wrong URL before to the house in East Dorset. But I was curious if it's the same thing, if that collection was either Bill's actual collection or if it was a composite between Bill's collection and books that have been donated to the Stepping Stone Library over time, or that's the really, you know, the real deal.
That's a great question. And before I answer it, the chat box had come up. So the book, How to Listen to God, was the Wally P book. And by the way, that was a life-changing book for me. So if ever you want to read a really good book, How to Listen to God by Wally P is a phenomenal book. Now to Felix's question. So I guess it's okay for me to say I am a member of the Archives and Collections Committee for Stepping Stones. So the books that are up at Stepping Stones are all books that were part of Bill and Lois's collection. And I'm sure many of them were given to them over the years. I can't say Bill read every one of them. I can't say Lois read every one of them. But everything in that house belonged to Bill and Lois. So to my knowledge, none of those are books that were placed in that house after Lois died. So certainly some of the books could have come after Bill died in 1971, if I'm remembering right. So, you know, that is their collection. Whereas up at the Griffith Library, that is almost all books that have been donated. And like I said, Dick B put most of that library together and donated it to Ozzy and oh my God, I'm getting so old. I can't remember her name. It'll come to me in a few minutes. But the Wilson House, which was owned by Ozzy and Bonnie Leper.
Thank you so much, John. Amazing. Don't be too hard on yourself. Your memory is unbelievable. I can't even remember my name sometimes. Dr. Z.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to introduce myself. I am a retired medical doctor. You're mentioning stepping stones. I graduated from New York Medical College in Valhalla. The thing that I just wanted to mention the name Bruce Washburn, who I met here in Plantation, Florida. I raised my family in West Orange, New Jersey, but Bruce, I believe his wife had something to do with General Service, and he was very much, you know, a source that I could ask any questions. The thing that often comes up, because I'm a physician, is Dr. Silkworth, I believe it's Roman numeral 26, chronic alcoholism is a manifestation of an allergy. And I often give the take that that was a hypothesis. He clearly stated it as a hypothesis. And it was the mid-30s, and it was the first time that alcoholism was put in the context of being a disease, and it was so radical he didn't even add his name to it. It's the doctor's opinion. I forget what issue they changed it to, Dr. Silkworth. But people still quote it as though it's gospel, and my best metaphor for that is, you know, when I drink, I break out into handcuffs. The other thing that troubles me, because I started in psychiatry, I'm now a retired internist cardiologist, that the denigration of the word ego, which I understand was a translation from Freud, and Freud uses the word ish, which clearly states I. The letter I, and ego has been denigrated to mean something demonic. The other one is Carl Jung, who I think was a fantastic source. I think you mentioned it, but he, and I forget actually when it was, but there was a museum at where the former Barney's was on 14th and Broadway. They had the exhibit on the book that was released after, you know, like 50 years after his death. And I forget what color is. It could be the red book. And his exploring of mysticism in the East and his exposition of demons. So that's I'm throwing a lot out there, and I really thank the work that you're doing. And I will be trying to contact you through the email. Thanks again.
Thanks, Doc. You know, when I looked up the word allergy, it means an adverse reaction to something. So when I drink, my adverse reaction is that I can't stop. So it's about, you know, I like the term. I hated it myself when I came. Allergy, I agree. I break out in handcuffs. So it's about, you know, semantics and stuff. Speaking, we have another. Oh, I'm sorry. I just muted you. I'm sorry, I unmuted you. Would you mute yourself? Unmute yourself?
I disagree, because it is in the context, this is a physician. And it's clearly, we honor the physician, and he's stating a medical hypothesis.
Okay. All right?
And it's somewhere in the literature, and I forget where, I have it, you know, one of the pamphlets, they kind of, you know, let us know that it is not good science today.
Okay.
I don't know when it was they decided we're not changing any of the words. You know, so that's, I understand why it's continued, because there was a vote, you know, that we keep it verbatim, which is not good science. Thank you.
Okay. Also, as far as the ego goes, the preeminent doctor is Dr. Harry Thiebaud, who does reference Dr. Freud. And I wanted to ask John, when the medical overview came, because Dr. Thiebaud got involved in 1939. He was presented, was it one of the first 400 books, John? And he gave it to Marty Mann, who rejected it. And then Marty read it, and she had a religious experience by going to church. She called it surrender. Because we've been studying it word by word now for, you know, a year. I do a meeting on Thursday. And he talks about the Freudian, the id and the ego and the superego, but his terminology, and he's a very humble man. He couldn't treat it with psychological techniques. Neither could Dr. Silkworth. You know, he knew we needed some kind of an entire psychic change, but he didn't know how to do that. And something happened with Bill and Ebby when they went through the original page 13 of the big book where, you know, Bill has the white light experience with step three and Ebby comes back and they proceed with the rest of the steps, which sounds like 12 to me, not six. But anyway, John, do you have anything about when did the medical overview at the end of the book, page 569 in the fourth edition, page 571 of the third edition?
So, I mean, there's so much that we just talked about, both the good doctor who was sharing and yourself. So I wouldn't even know where to begin, but I will mention this. So Silkworth actually published a paper in 1937. And if I remember right, it was published in The Lancet, which, you know, Silkworth came out with his theory that alcoholism was the manifestation of an allergy. And of course, if the good doctor contacts me, I'll send him a copy of that paper. Silkworth also wrote the letter to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1938 that opens the doctor's opinion. And by the way, he signed the letter. So Joe and Charlie like to, again, bring levity and say, oh, don't put my name on this because they'll run me right out of the medical society for this. But Silkworth published the paper under his own name. So the anonymity in the big book comes from the authors of the big book, not Silkworth. Silkworth signed the letter, and I have a copy of the signed letter, so I can tell you in all certainty, you know, that is true. Now, by the way, there's still plenty of controversy as to what alcoholism is and isn't. So Howard Jelinek in 1960 published a book called The Disease Concept of Alcoholism. And it's an interesting book. You should read it. And Bunky Jelinek, who was very close to Marty Mann and Dr. Tebow, you know, there has never been and never will be unanimity in what alcoholism is. And I'm going to tell you, although people say, well, this is what it is, there is still no definitive catch-all, include-all, this is it, irrefutably. You know, some people still reject the disease concept of alcoholism. And, you know, it's not for us to say, well, it is or it isn't. We all have our little pet theories and we all throw our support behind something that makes sense to us. And by the way, the big book said, you know, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcoholism interests us, right? That's what they say in the big book. But he says its soundness, as laymen, its soundness means little to us. Meaning, in other words, well, we're not going to get involved in that because we don't know if it's true or not. It sounds interesting, right? But he says as ex-problem drinkers, and that's what, or ex-alcoholics, as he wrote in the first edition, it makes great sense to us because it explains things which we could otherwise not account for. So over the years, that allergy theory has helped many alcoholics because in the early days, it was all sin. Alcoholics and drinkers are sinners, and that didn't help us. Tell us we were sick and maybe we had this kind of allergy type thing and we could start to get with, well, maybe I need to do something about it. So that allergy theory helped a lot of people over the years. So I wouldn't throw it out with the bathwater just so quickly. And whether it's true or not, you know, Bill used to say it was like an allergy. And I'm going to tell you, Bill also did not accept the disease concept of alcoholism. He gave a talk in 1961 or 62 and said, technically, it's not a disease. You know, it's an illness. We preferred to call it an illness. Now, I know people will take exception to what I'm saying, but these are Bill's words. And by the way, just because Bill said it, don't make it so either. I'm going to tell you what alcoholism is. The jury is still out. Just like what addiction is and its exact nature, the jury is still out. Stick around, more will be revealed, right?
Thanks, John. Listen, I am, for those that asked about the Big Book meeting tonight and there's a Sermon on the Mount, we put up the primetimeisnow.com website. This group, John, talks about, we don't talk about drinking anymore. We talk about alcoholism being an ism. It is. It's the thinking. And that step one has two parts. The first part is I'm powerless over alcohol, the only time alcohol is mentioned in all 12 steps. And that dash is an M dash. And that my life is unmanageable, yes, due to my alcohol, my powerlessness. But I get sober and my alcoholism is still there. I act out. And that's why, you know, in the fourth step, it says our liquor was but a symptom. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. So, so we talk about alcoholism, ego, and self, and that's what we're up against. And it's an ism, not a wasm. It's an interesting format. A lot of people here with time, you know, they've done all the work and they come here and they hear something refreshing, like, oh, I can go further. And, you know, all the doctors in the past, Dr. Silkworth and Dr. Tebow with their techniques, Dr. Silkworth would lock you up and you go out and drink again. It's an unbelievable phenomenon. And what we found is it's one alcoholic talking to another. It's these 12 steps. There's something special about AA. So we have to try to not get in caught up in the semantics. Yeah. And Bill only mentions disease once in the Big Book on page 64, all forms of spiritual disease. And that's what it is. So, but listen, I'm going to stay on the iPad. I got to open up my Sermon on the Mount on this and then I will be gone at one. Howard, are you going to be able to stay on?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, John, thank you so, so much. You know, and all the presenters, thank you so much. I also wanted to ask about Hank Parkhurst, you know, cause we've talked about it and, you know, and somebody was kind of making a snide comment about Bill W and the whole thing stolen. And listen, no one said this book was original. He put it together so well. It's God inspired and it's borrowed from all kinds of things. So we have to be a little kinder to Bill W. He was a flawed man with an ego. And thank God he talked about it. He knew our dispositions to it. You know, he talked about himself and I can relate to it. But it was Hank Parkhurst. He drank again, right? And he did leave, right? And they got in a fight because he thought he deserved some of the royalties as well.
So Parkhurst is a very long story. But, you know, Parkhurst was one of Bill's earliest sponsees. Parkhurst was the first person on the New York side to get sober. He was Bill's partner in the Big Book. Both Bill and Hank were both very headstrong. I think they both wanted to be the leader of AA. You know, Hank had an affair with Ruth Hock, who was the secretary of Honor Dealers, and Bill interfered in that relationship. You know, when they started issuing stock for the book, Hank wrote president of Works Publishing on the stock. And of course, somebody went to Bill and said, you can't let them do that. And then when the bill was published, when the book was published, Bill copyrighted the book in his name and Hank got paranoid that I'm being cut out of this. And Hank ended up relapsing sometime in late August or early September of 1939. We know that because Lois wrote about it in her diary. And there was a lot of fighting between Bill and Hank and a lot of resentments and is a very, very long history regarding everything that went on around that. And we could spend hours and hours talking just about that. But to Craig's point, you know, we were just a bunch of drunks, and we still are today, and we still fight amongst ourselves, and we still get resentments, and we disagree over words and concepts and all of these things. And I think that first tradition is wonderful, where it says, okay, you know, all that stuff's human, but our common welfare comes first, and that's the most important thing. And that's where we differ from the Washingtonians, that we need to stay united, that our primary purpose is just to stay sober and help another alcoholic.
John, thank you so much. I could listen to you all day, buddy, and you're awesome. Everybody looking to you. Yeah, so go ahead.
Greg, I can't chat, but I have an appointment for a COVID vaccine at 4:30, so I'm going to have to go. It takes me about 20 minutes to drive there, but again, I'm so proud to be part of this committee, and John is just a wonderful wealth of information. And, you know, you're talking about ego, and I'm just looking at the forward in the second edition where it says, from the doctor, the broker learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced the need of moral inventory, confession, personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in dependence upon God. And the first tenet is complete deflation. And there it is with the ego. And that's one thing Bill couldn't do until he came. And there's all this great information of the wealth that John's turned me onto, and the books that I've gotten through eBay and that on these early books, and some great things out there. And you mentioned Dick B's got a lot of great books too. That is a nice segue about how Frank Buckman was a great influence on Sam Shoemaker. And that's where it's all, you know, 1918 in China where they first met. And it's just a wonderful way to live my life now. And again, I thank everybody for being here and as part
Frank, I want to thank you so much because Steve hooked me up with Frank, and him and I have been, and he consulted with you guys. So it's been a lot of people involved in this, and thank you to the whole group. All right. And we'll stay in touch. And we'll have this thing up on the website. Howard will probably get it up there shortly. We'll figure out if you can get him the slides, and then we'll figure out how to get you. You know, you can download it from the website's awesome. So thank you again, all of you, so much. And so, Howard, if you want to call on the next people with their hands up. Frank.
Oh, you're welcome, Joe. Thank you, John, so much. And everybody, God bless everyone. And, there it is. The power of God goes deep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okie dokie. Craig, thank you for leading the meeting and for being and setting it up.
Yeah, well, Howard does so much for us, just so you guys know. Really humble guy and very experienced, and we're very blessed to have him on our side, that's for sure. Howard, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, we were talking about big ego. You know, we don't want to go too far in that direction, but...
Anyway, guys, have a great rest of the meeting, and I'll get to listen to it. Thank God on the website. Any more great questions? Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you, Craig.
Take care, Craig. Ross, you're next up. Ross's iPad.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I had my hand up. I do have a question, though. Buckman's biography is called Tales of a Comet, and there's a chapter in it specifically about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober in Cleveland, Ohio, and the Oxford group got to Akron through Harvey Firestone and a guy by the name of Jim Newton. And the Cleveland contingent had to break away from the Oxford group for religious reasons. They were mostly working class Irish and German Catholics. But what I want to know is why did ultimately the New York and Akron group broke away from the Oxford group, and why did that split come about?
So that's an interesting story. So, you know, one of the things Carl Jung talked about was synchronicity, right? That seemingly at different times, unrelated events are taking place that in fact have a common purpose. And that may not be a textbook definition of synchronicity, but that's kind of like the gist of it. So it's interesting that, you know, Ebby brought the Oxford group message to Bill in the town's hospital, or even before, you know, so the little talk at the kitchen table where Ebby says, you know, I joined up with this group, you know, the whole story of now Ebby being arrested in Vermont and Roland Hazard and Seba Graves and Shep Cornell bringing the Oxford group message to Ebby and Ebby sobering up. So Bill sobered up and immediately joined the Oxford group. And he was all in, you know, so Bill was on fire with this spiritual experience. And Bill became very, very active in the Oxford group. And then interestingly enough, so he's got his trip to Akron in May of 1935 and the deal to take over the national rubber company goes downhill and there's Bill ready to drink. And through the series of phone calls, he ends up at the Seibeling estate talking to Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob is an Oxford group member, right? So there's the synchronicity and you can't miss it. And Dr. Bob, who had been a member of the Oxford group for a couple of years, was trying to work the spiritual solution, but he didn't know the problem. He didn't know about, you know, this theory of alcoholism being an allergy. And when Bill told him everything he learned from Silkworth, Bob could finally get it. He said, I never knew any of that. So, you know, you can't work step two until you have step one is kind of the way of putting it. But so they were very much Oxford group, okay? You know, so they were the drunk squadron of the Oxford group. The Oxford group was a group of people practicing first century Christianity, trying to improve their lives. It wasn't about drunks. But when the drunks followed this little practical program of action and the four absolutes, they sobered up. So it was interesting that this program could do what medicine and religion had failed to do to a large degree. But religion was sobering up drunks for years, but they didn't have a huge success rate because they hadn't streamlined these religious ideas into such forms that the alcoholic could accept, which is what Bill did so well. Now, so in 1936, Bill is attending Oxford group house parties and conferences and all of this. So one of the things that the Oxford group started to get down on Bill about was what was called lone wolfing. So the Oxford group also had an idea of tradition one that said, you know, hey, we all work together for our common good. And Bill was so focused on drunks that, you know, some of the Oxford groupers were saying to Bill, well, maybe you ought to get with the larger program. And, you know, some of the Oxford group was taking Bill's inventory. So, you know, even though Bill had sobered up and had a great spiritual experience, Bill could still curse a little bit. He was a chain smoker. He had an eye for the ladies. And I think some of the Oxford groupers were taking Bill's inventory, if I could say it like that. And Bill was getting pissed off. And the Oxford group started to say, well, Bill and Lois are not, quote unquote, maximum, meaning they haven't had this maximum experience of God. So there was some gossip and, you know, the word that Bill was having these Tuesday night gatherings for alcoholics only at his house, you know, the Oxford group started to speak out against it. And they said, you know, you guys shouldn't be going to these secret meetings. So Bill ended up, you know, telling the Oxford group, look, you know, I can't go in for this. So I guess it was kind of a mutual parting of the ways. But the funny thing is, so Bill would later come up with tradition one that says our common welfare would come first. But yet within the Oxford group, he wasn't practicing that. So whether or not that's good or bad or AA never would have come about or, and Joe and Charlie say it, right? We don't know. Maybe instead of just 2 million, there could have been 10 million if we'd have stayed with the Oxford group. Who knows? Doesn't matter. It is what it is. But Bill broke off from the Oxford group and he would later come up with lots of reasons why. Well, we couldn't accept the absolutes. We didn't like our inventory being taken. We didn't want to be told it had to be this way. But the funny thing is the Akronites were doing pretty good on the Oxford group. And the Akron and Clevelandites seemed to be having a greater success rate following the more rigid first century Christianity program. Whereas in New York with Parkhurst and Burwell and those guys, they were being a little more psychological rather than spiritual. So certainly I'm able to see the correlation between those. And then once Akron got so big, they realized they too had to break off from the Oxford group. And like somebody mentioned, you know, so Cleveland, they had to leave because of religious reasons. You know, they were Catholic and they said, you can't be up there in those Protestant meetings. So as a historian and one who has read all of the literature, the Oxford group sometimes gets a bad recollection in history. And I think Bill tried to correct that later on in life. Everything we do came from the Oxford group. All of the principles that we practice today came from the Oxford group. And the Oxford group didn't invent them either. They came from ancient sources. You know, if you read what is the Oxford group, it's all clearly spelled out. So when you hear somebody say, oh, we broke away from the Oxford group because of it, that's Bill talking. And Bill was defending his reasons why. But we owe a great debt to the Oxford group. And we are a part of the Oxford group. Remember, now I'm going to get a little biblical, right? A good tree doesn't produce bad fruit. So even the Galileans said, you will know the tree by the fruit. So AA is the fruit of the Oxford group. Always will be. So I hope that answered that question.
Thank you, John. Peter C.
Yeah. Hey, John. Thanks. I just had a quick question. I wanted to know, it was related to what you were just talking about. It was my understanding that one of the reasons why AA broke off from Oxford Group is because, there wasn't inclusivity and Bill really wanted this program available to anybody, regardless of their background, race, ethnicity, of course, anything like that. So I wonder if you had anything to offer on that. We didn't have in Oxford Group, you had to subscribe to the deity, I think, as you've covered. So just wanted your thoughts on that. Thanks.
So if you read the Oxford Group literature, even though they were first century Christianity, they did not have any rule that, oh, you had to adopt Christianity. You know, they were pretty wide open. And right in the what is the Oxford Group opening, it says, you know, we are not affiliated with any particular sect or denomination. So the Oxford Group was very inclusive for that time. So you got to remember in the 30s, society was society. So there were different classes of people and different stereotypes and prejudices that existed, not a lot different than throughout history. But I have never heard would lend credence to that the Oxford Group was exclusive. They let all the drunks in, and they were happy to have the drunks come in because they saw people leading changed lives. And that was the main purpose of the Oxford Group, for people's lives to change. In fact, one of the books is called The Life Changers. And Sam Shoemaker, who was the head of the Oxford Group in New York, pretty much in America, gave many talks over the years where he says, you know, wherever the newcomer is, you don't try to give the newcomer your message from here. You got to get down to their level and bring them in, right? So if you want what we have, right? So if you want what I have, and, you know, Sandy Beach always talked about this. So if they're not getting with the book, throw the book away to start, okay? Meet them at their own level. And then as they grow, they're bound to gain depth in understanding, right? So it's an amazing thing.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Dr. D.
Yes, thanks again. It's kind of embarrassed. It's a technical thing. I may have missed in the introduction to this symposium. What is happening? You know, how do I tap into what you're doing? Somebody keeps on mentioning a website. I don't know what the website is, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how do we get the proceeds of this?
I'll repost that information right now. Basically, it's primetimeisnow.com, and it'll be up there, linked from the front page, by tomorrow morning. Here are the links coming up directly.
Thank you.
There you are. So just go to the base URL of that, primetimeisnow.com, and it'll have a link to this audio. And
so, Howard, it's about 4 o'clock. I think we've gone about 3 hours. So
that's right.
Unless there's a burning desire out there, I think maybe now is as good a time as any to end it.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, John, and everyone else that had anything to do with putting this together. It's been a real pleasure to listen to. I've learned a lot, and I'm just really glad that we've had the opportunity to do this. And why don't I turn it over to you for some last words?
So I would just thank everyone for participating. Thank you to the Primetime Group in Los Angeles for inviting us. It was certainly a wonderful way to spend the afternoon. And what an international group you had. It was truly a privilege for me. And I think I speak on behalf of Frank and the rest of the Archives Committee from New Jersey. It was certainly a pleasure and a privilege to be able to join all of you today.
Okay, I wanted to mention that the chat is going to be saved, but it's going to be edited so that last names are not included for anonymity concerns. The audio is saved, but the video is not. So that's what we got. And also beginning the PDF with the slides, hopefully to put them up by tomorrow. And we'll put it together in a package for everybody to open up and use. So I guess, this is an AA meeting. Do we want to pray our way out?
Howard, why don't you guys close in whatever is your usual manner?
Okay, well, we usually close with a prayer, and given this group, probably want to do the Serenity Prayer. So after a moment of silence for the alcoholic still suffering, Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you so much. Recording.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.